Hi, hello, it's Vin. Thank you so much for listening to The Vin and Ali Show. We've created something that we're really excited about and we want to share it with you. It's called Recalibrate. It's a 12-step process that helps you create more clarity and more alignment in your life. It's the exact approach that both Ali and I have been using to live happier lives and to achieve all of our wildest dreams in the last 7 years. It's been crazy. Being one of our loyal listeners, we wanted to share a special something with you. Visit recalibrate.online/Vin and Ali to access the course for 70% off. I hope you will check it out. Anyway, let's dive into this episode. Hello. Hi. Welcome to the Vin and Ali Show.
I thought you were saying hi to them.
I'm not saying hello to you. I'm saying hello to all of our listeners.
Hi.
We haven't done this in a while. This is our first podcast back this year in 2024. How do you feel?
Exciting. But I was just looking at you just before and I'm like, are you nervous?
I don't think it's nervous. It's like, I'm feeling, do I still remember how to do this?
I hope so, because if you don't, I'm screwed.
Well, welcome back to us. I'm glad to be back, a little nervous to be back.
Yeah.
But I actually am really excited to be back because I think during the last 3 to 4 months, I haven't been reading as much. And knowing that we were doing this podcast put me back into reading mode. And it just reminded me of how much I missed learning and reading. And the book we're covering in this particular podcast, as we make our comeback for 2024, is Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell.
And I think just it's also important to note, you haven't not been reading because you've been lazy or not committed.
Yeah.
You had some exciting news.
Baby girl has arrived. Melody. Melody's She's here. Arrived and, oh man, it's been 5 years waiting for her. So she took a damn sweet time. But it's just been
worth the wait.
Absolutely.
It's amazing.
Absolutely worth the wait. And do you mind if I use this little bit of time to just kind of talk through the last couple of months real quick? Is that all right?
You do whatever you want.
It's our podcast, right? We do whatever we want.
I don't know why you're
asking. Yeah, I don't know why I'm asking.
Who are you asking them? Like,
is even if you said no, I'd still do it.
Yeah.
But it's been so beautiful in that. When Xander was born, I was living in the US and I was in the US with my wife, Pei Wen. I was on the road 180 days a year. So I missed out so much of my son's childhood because I was trying to grow the career and everything. But when I was reflecting on the thing that I'm the most proud of in the last quarter of the year, the first quarter of the year, is that since my daughter was born, Melody, I've bathed her every single night of her life so far. Every night, it's me. And that's probably the thing I'm the most proud of it comes to my own life in the last 3 months. And it's been so wonderful to be present with her and really feel like I'm being a good dad, you know? So that far out. Sorry to steal the thunder from you, Malcolm, but
yeah.
I just wanted to mention that because, man, it feels great, you know? And you know when babies just look into your eyes, they just kind of look into your soul. I've had so many of those moments. It's
that's
beautiful.
What we were saying this morning, even just seeing her, just so grounding, right? Like babies are just so pure. They don't have all of the stuff that we're filled with.
They're not stressed about mortgages, bills. Right. They're not stressed about the business not doing well.
just sleeping or like...
I think I've got a fart. Yeah. I need you to move my legs. Yeah. You know, and that's it, man. Life is how simple. You should move my legs later. I've been a little constipated lately. I'm going to lay down and you just got to move my legs.
Yeah, I don't know if we'll do that, but that's a nice thought.
We're doing it.
All right, we'll get video of that after the pod. But no, I've just done the other side as well. I've just been so proud of you as well, like watching, you know, over the last few months. And obviously, that's why things like the podcast and all that, we just put it on hold. But just watching you really go all in on your family and, you know, on the birth of Melody as well. It's been awesome to watch and congrats. And yeah, she's perfect. So
thanks.
That's awesome. Can't wait to dig into this.
I feel like we need a hug. Can we hug?
Yeah, let's hug. No one will see that hug if you're listening on audio. But we just
They know it happened. Yeah. They know it happened. Yeah. No, thank
they
you,
felt
man.
It. They'll feel it.
And how about you? Give us a little quick update on Ali's life in the first quarter of 2024.
No, nothing's happened. I've just been waiting for you to like pretty much since the last pod. It's been really uneventful and just been waiting for this pod. Imagine just somebody sitting in a quiet room, sitting there and
Wow.
waiting for life to
That sounds awfully boring.
Yeah, no, just me.
Okay.
It's a long game.
You nothing. Just there's nothing you want to share? Nothing at all?
Oh, no, we had a really cool start to the year, so lots of exciting things happening with Future Golf, which is the business. So we're looking at, yeah, some exciting opportunities in that space, some really cool partnerships that we've been able to bring together, which has been awesome. Recently moved house, which is really exciting. So family home has been, updated, and that's been really cool. Just have a new environment, and everyone's settled into that really nicely. But they're probably my biggest ones.
Hey, that's amazing, man! All right, well, let's not keep Malcolm waiting.
No, let's not keep him waiting.
Let's get into Outliers.
You think he's waiting?
No, it was a fun metaphor, and then you called it out. Yeah, no, and you called it out, and now it's weird.
Like, I just want to be honest with our audience. I don't think Malcolm gives how a crap about this.
How weird would it be if we actually started getting the authors to come on, but then they're not allowed to be a part of the show? They just have to sit on the side while we talk about
them. If any of them, like, because your following's pretty big now, I wonder if any of them have actually listened to an episode.
Yeah, well, Robert Green.
Oh, yeah.
He sent me a personalized copy of 48 Laws of Power with my name in it.
That's pretty cool.
So he's definitely listened to that. Okay.
There we go.
Which is pretty cool. All right. Well, whether Malcolm's waiting or not, let's get into this book.
Let's assume he's not.
Yeah, he's still not. But the greatest thing about this book selection was, I think you said to me, this was one of the first books you read before you started your reading spree.
Yeah.
So tell me, how did you feel going into this one? Because this is also one of the first books I read.
Yeah. Well, it was like going back, and I remember how mind-blowing this book was. I think I read it maybe 2011 is when I was looking back at the notes. And that was, like it was probably one of the first five books that I read, call it as a more mature adult.
Wow.
Right? And it blew my mind just in terms of, and I remember reading it the first time and just being so awed by this concept of, you know, like the 10,000 hour rule and success. And like, it's now everyone knows about that, right? Yeah. Like it's so mainstream. But then coming back to it now, 13 years later, and just being like, oh, so much of this is like, just nearly felt like common knowledge or whatever. So it was just like reflecting on that journey of reading and developing. And one of the biggest things that I got out of this book is the 10,000 hour rule. I remember writing notes back then. And I was like, well, what's something that I can do over the next 10 years? Right, that can potentially lead me to an outlier level of success. And the thing that I had noted down was to read 1,000 books. Yeah, and that was one of the big things that I got from that book. So that book actually started a lot of, I think, potentially the entrepreneurial journey, potentially the development and self, you know, exploration journey came from that. Because for the first time, it was written in a way where I was like, hey, if you actually just commit time and do the work on something over an extended period of time, essentially, it can have awesome results. So it was nice revisiting that book because of that.
It may even led to this friendship and this podcast.
Potentially.
Because if it didn't get you on that reading journey, you wouldn't have enjoyed reading so much.
For sure.
We do this podcast because of our love for reading. Yeah. You know, so that's beautiful. Right. Wow.
Well, it also got me really interested in masters of their craft. Right. So there could even be something there, like when I saw you and I was like, hey, well, here's somebody that's putting in the time, right? And we'll jam on that a little bit more as we get into it. But what about you?
I felt like I time traveled with this book.
Yeah.
In that it brought me back to around 2012, 2013. And that's when I first came across this book.
Similar times.
Yeah. Similar era. And it just made me remember what it was like when I didn't have much success in my life. And an era of my life where I felt like a little bit of a failure. So it was so nostalgic going back to this. I was like, I remember where I was when I read this. You know, I remember sitting in the back of mum and dad's takeaway store trying to read the book because smart people read. And I was still thinking I need to read more because I want to be smart. You know, and just little things like that. It just flooded back all these memories of where I even read certain things. Like I remember exactly where I was when I first discovered the 10,000 hour rule. Because I immediately, and I was in the back of the takeaway store. I still remember this. It was in the back of the takeaway store. I went 10,000 hours over 10 years. That means if you take 365 and you times that by 10, and then you take that number and you divide it by 10,000, that's 3 hours a day. Yeah. So if I spent 3 hours a day doing something for the next 10 years, I'm going to get outlier levels of success. So I just remember that was the simplest equation for success for me. And that was it. That was what got me down the path of, right, so mastery is critical. And you now know mastery is such a big value of mine. I think it was birthed from that mathematical equation.
Amazing.
Bro, 3 hours a day. Yeah. If it costs 3 hours a day for the next 10 years for you to be an outlier, of course you'll do it. Yeah. But I think people now want results in 12 months, yeah. not 10 years.
And it's funny just talking about that 10,000 hour rule. Like, I know that's been debunked. Yeah. Some people are like, oh, it's like 16,000 hours.
Well, or, regardless of what it is.
You could do it in 1,000 hours.
Sleep faster and do it in 1 hour.
But the overarching concept there is, if you want outstanding results, you have to practice and commit to something for an extended period of time. And I love that we're doing this book because I don't know if I've met anyone else in my life that's probably committed to this more than you. And I've seen you do it multiple times in multiple different areas.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And I would say you're being generous when you say that I'll only commit 3 hours a day. You're the only person I know that can cram 10,000 hours in like 6 months.
I don't even know if there's that many hours in there. But you go hard,
right? Like you go pretty intense for very long periods of time.
Yeah, I do.
So, in saying that, if you just look at that concept of the 10,000 hours,
let's start there.
What sort of tips do you have for somebody that's sitting there and maybe listening to this right now and they want to pick up a new skill? How would you approach building out? Like, I know you mentioned there three hours a day
for
3 years as one of the concepts. How would you actually flesh that out so it's practical? Because I guess what I'm asking you is, how do you actually break down your way of mastering a skill using this type of approach?
Something that I teach in my classes now that I reckon has taken me the last 2 years to formulate is what I call the mastery cycle. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the mastery cycle, the first step of it is try and apply. And the reason why I kind of created the first step as try and apply is because we overthink shit in life. Before someone creates a video for social media, they go, I got to get the right hook. I got to make sure I've got the right bit of content. I got to make sure I change angles and B-roll. I got to make sure. So what ends up happening is analysis paralysis, and people end up not trying anything and they just ideate and then do nothing about it. That's why the first step in mastering something is learn one little thing and then immediately try and apply. Mm. Avoid that mindset of, I'm not going to do it until it's perfect. No, just try and apply. And I think the first step of mastery, if you can just try and apply something, you're already leaps and bounds ahead of the majority of people. Mm. Now, here is where you can get even ahead of more. Mm. Second step of the mastery cycle is reflect and review on the trying and applying. Mm. You actually have to sit down and go, well, how did that piece of content go? Sure, I didn't really spend too much time thinking about the hook and but how did it go? Oh, wow, it didn't get that many views. Okay, well, why didn't it get that many views? Well, maybe I was right. I need to work on the hook. Mm. And then after you've reviewed and reflected on the experience, then the third step is just plan on how you're going to improve your next iteration. Mm. So what are you going to do next? Okay, well, next time I create that social media video, I'll create the same social media video, except the only thing I'm going to work on is the hook. So I'm going to create 5 variations of it, 5 different hooks, and then post it on 5 different platforms. Mm. And what do you do after that? Back to step one, try and apply again. Mm. So next time you post it on 5 different platforms, and then after you do that, you review specifically which platform did the best. Oh, wow, on TikTok, this particular version did the best. Why? Oh, it's because the hook was a question. The others were statements. Interesting. Mm-hmm. All right, so what am I going to do next? I'm going to come up with 5 different questions as 5 different hooks for the same piece of content, post it again on 5 different platforms. Mm. And the more cycles you can go through, the faster you start to improve. Whereas the majority of people, Ali, whether it's content, improving the communication skills, don't even get to step one. So I follow that process. And I just relentlessly go through as many cycles as I can, as quickly as I can. I don't obsess over making the perfect thing. I rather obsess, how many circles can I go around? How many times can I go through this?
How quickly
can I go through this? And the faster I go through it, the better I get, the more progress I get.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
It's so simple.
It is.
Right? Like that instruction is so simple.
So simple.
But it's like, it's nearly like the advice of, hey, you can't just go to the gym once.
Yeah.
You've got to go a few times for it to have
That's right.
Over an extended period of time.
I don't relate to that gym one at all because I don't go. So,
but like, if you did. Yeah,
still working that one out.
If you did, it would work. The mentality is absolutely there. And it's interesting how so many people want success or they want this version of mastery or skill development. But you're right. Why don't people get past that first step? What I always think about this because we speak to so many people and they've got this innate desire. Like they're like, I want to do this. And I've got friends of mine as well that they'll speak about wanting to do something for 2 years, for 3 years. Yeah. But that first step is actually like in my head, I can't really sometimes comprehend it, right? Like I simplify it so much. I'm like, oh, why don't you just get started?
Yeah.
And then we'll catch up again. Yeah. The same conversation. I'll be like, oh, yeah, I still want to do that thing. It's like, yeah, but why didn't you? Like, why didn't you get started?
Yeah.
And then they'll be like, oh, I didn't have time or I didn't do this. It's like, oh, well, but you're spending time now talking about wanting to do it.
And spending time thinking about
and
it.
And then I'm sure you've spent months thinking about it.
And watching YouTube videos on it.
Like, why don't you just do it?
That's right.
So why don't people do it?
I think the major reason why people don't do it is because, well, there's many components, okay? But I think people have this illusion that there's a time and a place where I'll be ready.
The perfect time.
The perfect time. I think the illusion of, oh, yeah, I'll be ready to do, that's bullshit. As much as I waited 5 years for Melody to get here, my daughter, I'm not ready for a second kid right now, bro. Am I ready? No.
You should be super prepared. I'm not
ready.
You should have been really prepared
for it. You would have thought I had 5 years to prepare for this. And when she arrived, I'm not ready. So I think human beings have this romanticized time where things will be perfect and ready. And I'll be ready to be a father of two. Yeah. I'm going to be ready for my business to grow into its next phase. I'm going to be ready and have time and energy to go to the gym. It's not real. If you think about anything you've done in your life.
And there's somebody that come and knock on the door and they're like, hey, Ali, you're now ready.
Yeah, you are now ready, son.
It's it's hilarious, but it's so funny how our brains work like that.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions first.
Yeah.
Were you ready to start Future Golf when you started it?
No, you're never ready.
You're not ready.
It's funny, right? You're not ready, but you are ready. Because it's like once you start something, you know what I mean? Like, it's like that's the trigger of ready. You're never going to be comfortable because I think there's a difference.
Yeah.
There's a difference between being ready and then I think there's an innate feeling of I want to feel fully comfortable.
Right.
You know, I want to feel so comfortable now that everything's quiet, the kids have gone to bed and now I can read the book, you know, like that. It's like we're nearly looking for this innate thing or it's like somebody coming up and be like, hey, Ali,
you're ready now. You're ready to start this really difficult journey.
Like everything's going to be roses because you're so ready that it's going to be the easiest thing. But the reality is it's never going to be fully comfortable and you're not fully prepared and you're not going to know exactly how the journey's going to unfold. But the day I started, obviously that was the day the universe said I was ready or like whatever, right? Like innately I started that day. Mm. Or maybe it's some people are more predisposed to just doing that. But I remember even going back to when we first started being friends, one of the things you used to always say, it's like, hey, I remember speaking to you about like speaking and all that sort of stuff. And you're like, the perfect time to start is actually yesterday. Mm. And that always rung so true. And you're right. Like if you're looking for planning out, hey, I'll do it in 6 months' time when everything's settled down or that. Yeah. Reality is it probably won't be like that. You've just got to kind of do it.
Just audit yourself too.
Yeah.
And look at your own life. Everything that you're currently doing, when you first did it, were you ready? Mm. No.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone can find a time in their life where they're like, no, you know what? I was so ready. I was so ready for that. And it just turned out great. You know? I think if you're being really honest with yourself, you've done everything before you were ready. And
people that do a lot of stuff as well, what they'll generally find is like, I probably shouldn't have waited that long. That's usually the one that comes out more so.
It's aligned with the biggest regret people have in life.
Yeah.
I should have done that earlier.
Yeah.
I should have did more should've of that. Waited. I should have did more of this.
Yeah.
I should have done that and I never did it. So I think one thing is the idea of ready. And if we do things in threes, I think it's nice.
Yeah.
I think a second thing that stops people is fear. Mm. They're afraid.
Yeah, for sure.
Afraid of failure.
How it'll look.
It's embarrassing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the same thing even when it comes to communication skills. I see my students suffer from this all the time. It's that fear of judgment. So, you know, I'm normally really quiet. But all of a sudden, if I go and talk really loud like this, then everyone's going to think I'm annoying and that I'm like, they don't care.
Yeah.
You know, we have all this fear about judgment when again, Mark Twain gives us this beautiful piece of wisdom where he says, you worry less about what people think about you when you realize how seldom they do. Mm. So we fear judgment, but that judgment isn't even real because other people are more concerned about what they're going to have for lunch, whether it should be a steak sandwich or if I should get a tuna sandwich because steak's a bit more expensive these days. So they're like thinking about sandwich, that. Yeah. We can do a steak sandwich after. I've got the ingredients. But basically, right?
I love that just got solved.
Yeah, I know.
Instantly. This made me so happy now. Yeah, like,
dude, it's a good steak sandwich. Yeah. I've got really good.
Maybe our shortest podcast yet.
Yeah, it's a really good cut of meat. But what I'm saying is people are more concerned about what they're going to have for lunch than they are about how you currently are using your voice. They are more concerned about what they're going to get at the grocery store tonight, which flavor of ice cream, then they care about you starting a content creation schedule. They don't care. So what I see as someone who's part magician is most people are creating the illusion of fear. So they create that. So they trick themselves into believing that illusion is real.
Yeah.
But it's not real.
Yeah.
No one cares. And I'm not saying that to be mean. I'm saying it to free people of the fear of judgment.
Right. It's funny with golf.
Yeah.
This happens so often.
Really?
Yeah, right.
Like you don't play golf because you're scared of what other people think?
Well, people are scared, right? Like, so say even like if you're playing an amateur golf event or you're going out and playing golf with a few friends, but if there's a perception that there's one really good golfer there, right? The other three that may be new or they play a little bit more casually or whatever, they'll come in with this fear, like this overwhelming fear of I'm going to embarrass myself. I'm going to ruin it for everyone and all that.
So do you play as a team in golf?
Well, you play as a group of four. Or you play as two. Like generally you play with somebody else while you're playing, right? So this fear is like pretty deep-seated for a lot of golfers. Mm. But I remember like one of the biggest things with Future Golf because we like try to help people get into the game, right? And I was sitting there, I'm like, one of the beautiful things when I'm telling somebody when they're out there, I'm like, the reality is even if you're playing with a good golfer, they're so worried about their own game because they're coming in with that same expectation. Yeah. You know, they're not even like they might notice like four of your golf swings. It doesn't matter what you're doing, you know, as long as you're just a fun person to hang out with and you're not doing anything ridiculous to hold, like, you know, wasting heaps of time or being rude and you're open to learning, it's going to be absolutely fine. You don't have to worry at all because we all started at that exact same spot and we all remember what it was like as well. So, yeah, it's an illusionary fear.
It's not real.
And it just stops people from wanting to play and it ruins their experience where none of that actually existed even while they were playing that round of golf.
Mm.
You know, like if you ask the other person, like, oh, no, Vin was great to play with. Yeah. You know, he was so nice to hang out with and like having a good chat. But your experience might have been like, that was the most stressful thing ever because like I hit it into the trees on that hole or my ball went in the water. And, you know, it's like, it doesn't matter.
So funny how it's like we create our own prisons.
Yeah.
And the prison bars are made of fear.
Right.
And it's all not real. Whether it's how you use your voice to how you go and play golf to this business idea you want to start, to you wanting to start creating content on social media. It like the way I see it is just we are creating our own prisons and then it stops us. Mm. So that's two things we've mentioned so far, right? What do you think is the third? What stops you from just starting? The first one is overthinking, analysis paralysis. The second thing is fear.
Yeah.
What do you think the third thing is?
The one that comes to mind is like a perspective on resources.
Okay.
Right? So many people are like, I don't have this.
Time, money, energy.
Yeah. I've got other priorities.
Yeah.
I can't do this right now.
Mm.
You know, and I think that one is. And then when you really dig deeper a lot of the times, because if it's something that, say, for example, that you know will light them up, that they've been talking about for a very long time, you break it down a little bit more, there is usually space for this thing to exist, even while everything else is going on. Like very rarely have I met someone that's had that reason of I don't have time, I don't have money or whatever, where within about 15 minutes, we haven't been able to figure out how you could make it work.
That's pretty cool.
You know, like generally speaking.
So does that mean that if something kind of even enters the realm of your mind, there's probably a way to make it? Otherwise, it probably would have never come into your mind. It's like I've never thought about buying a sports team.
Yeah.
Probably because I can't.
We just did.
No, we didn't. We just did. But you know what I mean? Yeah. Is if something actually makes its way into your head,
there's
probably a way to do it. Well,
it's a book called Big Magic by-
The Magic of Thinking Big?
No, it's called Big Magic, written by the author who wrote Eat, Pray, Love.
Right.
I can't remember her name. I read it recently.
Mm.
And there's this beautiful piece in it, and I'm going to butcher it a little bit, but it's around like how- the magic of ideas and thoughts and where they actually come from and how like they're like little gifts, right, that come from the ether or wherever. And if you're a creative person, you're probably going to be a little bit more attuned to that where you'll get that flow of inspiration. It's like, I'm going to go draw it or write a song about it or I'll do that thing. But like if you don't honor, like there's something that happened in that moment that made that thought occur. Mm. And every time it's like a little trigger. So if you're that person that's been having this thought that I need to do this thing for the last 6 months, it's like there's something subconsciously happening where like the universe or whatever, your subconscious or whatever you want to call it, it's coming from a place that you don't maybe really understand. And it's sort of knocking on the door. And at some point, it's probably going to stop knocking or it'll take that same concept, that same idea, and it'll go give it to somebody else. You know, and that's kind of her belief. It's like that idea is nearly transmitted. She has this awesome example of a book that she was writing, right? And she nearly mapped out the whole thing, but she didn't end up writing the book. Then she met this person while she was overseas that was speaking. And that person was like, I've got this book idea. And it's like this. And she's like, that is essentially the exact same idea. And so her concept was, well, the idea went to me. I kind of said no to it.
Oh,
and that went to this other person. And then we were brought together. And then that person, like, it was maybe 3-4 different small details that were different, but the concept of that piece of art was nearly the exact same thing. And then that other person went and wrote the book, right? And then she's like, well, I could have been upset about it and been like, oh, well, that was kind of my idea and I should have done it. But the reality was at that given period of time or that point in time, I wasn't ready to accept it, right? That other person did it and they did a great job and that's awesome. But it's like that same thing, you know, when you see like – and. Then the thing is like, why do when we see a new idea, usually there's been 2 or 3 people working on it at similar times in different parts of the world, right? So it's like, it was a really interesting concept like that.
Yeah. And I think some people have felt it before too, where you're like, I had that idea. Like Kogan in Australia, that electronics company, right? How many people sat there and went, I had that idea, right? Isn't that interesting? Yeah. It's like ideas are a life form.
Yeah, they're a life form.
They move from person to person.
And then some people act up. I know, it was really cool when I was reading
it. I've never thought of it like that.
It's an awesome book, Big Magic. I know we're talking about outliers.
Well, what's interesting is, again, just to jam on that for a moment, it means that these ideas and visions, they visit you.
Yeah.
And if you have the right mindset, you can welcome it in and give life to it. Otherwise, it's going elsewhere.
And
that's crazy.
And the other concept there is too, is maybe you only get a finite number of these.
Oh, man, that makes it even more sad.
Right? Like, and if you don't-
You only have so many visitors in one lifetime, and if you don't let any of them in, then you'll die lonely.
There's a concept there, right? Dude. Like, if the universe keeps knocking on the door, but you just keep ignoring that call.
Oh, wow.
Right? Like, we read The Alchemist. I think that was our first thing, and it talks about omens and being open to it.
That was our first pod,
right? Like, I personally believe that there's some magic in that.
Well, this podcast was an omen.
Yeah.
It knocked on our door for years before we decided to do it.
We just used to chat like this. Well, we always chat like this.
Yeah,
we did a 2-hour podcast before the podcast.
Yeah. But that makes it very bittersweet, isn't it? Because, it's funny how it's come up again, but that's so aligned with what people regret.
Yeah.
What people tend to regret, if you'd use this metaphor, is so many beautiful ideas and dreams have knocked on my door and I never gave any of them life. And my biggest regret is I should have given them life.
And I think it's a cool thing for us to talk about, right? Because I think we're two people that do take action, even if it's not always great. But then over a period of time, we've been able to align that with opportunities and timing and, you know, our strengths and all that.
Yeah.
And I've just got so much gratitude that that's how this version of life has unfolded for me. You know, and I don't take it for granted or take it lightly. And I know that how many other people have played a role in that. But just that simple thing that whatever my innate makeup was, it just didn't give enough shits to not do stuff. You know, like there was a combination of things that came together where I was like, well, I'm just going to try things. And even if it fails miserably, I'm happy to live on that. And we have this platform where you can actually share that with others that have maybe been sitting there and just be like, look, there's nothing really all that special about us. No. And that's what this book tells you as well.
Yeah.
Like even when we look
Let's talk about one of the concepts in that. There are invisible threads that help the successful become successful.
For sure. And it is a really cool concept because we glorify these outrageous individual underdog stories. Yeah, yeah. And it's like, oh, like, how did Vin go from being, you know, like, because and I don't really jam on this, right? Because your story to me is incredible. Yeah. Like, it is 100% an outlier story. But it's like, I really want us to spend time tracing through that.
Yeah.
And then being like, well,
dissect it.
Yeah. Where were all these little things? Because, like, high level, your story is son of refugee family.
Yeah.
You know, all the, you would say, most of the odds and the deck was stacked against you. And then somehow you've then navigated, like, even going back to the fact that you've spoken about it before, where all of your family members were going to university and becoming pharmacists and stuff. And you're like, I've got a packet of cards, like, you
know, magic,
working at a petrol station, like all these things. It's like, how does it go from that to where you are now? And because it is like a very true outlier story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I wonder if this book holds up. And if there's, and this is what I wanted to ask you about.
Maybe I am amazing, aren't I?
you're an outlier, an outlier beyond the book.
Yeah. Maybe he needs to rewrite this book.
Yeah.
No. Can I do a metaphor for metaphor?
Metaphor away.
As we jam on this topic.
Yeah.
So it's funny. You got like a new home. So did I.
Yeah.
And right now I've got a bit more of a garden and I've got fruit trees.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's really cool. I've never had this many fruit trees before. And when I first came to the property, I went, man, this apple tree right here is amazing. The fruit tastes so amazing. It's so beautiful. Like, the birds aren't getting it. It's fantastic. And I gave that tree so much goddamn credit. Yeah. Okay. Then there's another tree around the corner, a pear tree. I'm like, pear trees are shit. This pear tree sucks, right? Because now the birds have gotten to it. The pears are tiny. It's just like, ugh. Like, man, let's plant more apple trees.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is a metaphor because I gave that apple tree too much credit. And this book reminded me that there are so many things surrounding the apple tree that I didn't give credit to. The apple tree had larger gum trees around it, giving it shade. The apple tree also had a really beautiful irrigation system that's right next to it. The apple tree may have better fertilized ground. The bird tree is also the apple tree is also tucked away where the birds, I don't think, even know it's there, right? Whereas this poor pear tree is out in the sun.
Out in the desert.
There's no irrigation system near it.
Your property has a desert.
Probably hasn't even had water in the last 4 years. Yeah. And I just made that straight bang out judgment that pear trees are shit and apple trees are fantastic. And this book reminded me that, Vin, you've got irrigation systems all around you. Vin, you've also got shade that's been casted over you. Vin, you've also got all these other bushes and trees protecting you from these damn evil birds that come and eat all your fruit, right? So then the question really to jam on is, what have been my irrigation systems? What have been my shade? What has been my trees protectors, right? And I have so many of them, Ali, that it almost reading this book has made me feel really not special. Like, reading this book has made me think
you have the least.
Yeah, I'm just like, wow. It's like, shit, I'm actually not impressive at all. The irrigation did all the work.
I had a thousand people really.
Wow, I'm a real shit kicker. Yeah. And man, this, like, everyone has lifted me. And if I didn't succeed, I would have been a piece of crap.
Yeah.
But again, let's jam on it, right? Because I was born with the two most amazing parents anyone could have ever asked for. Dude, that immediately made me think of my mum and my dad. Because when everybody else in my friendship group was becoming doctors, lawyers, pharmacists, psychologists, and engineers and accountants, I dropped out of university, man, to go work at a petrol station and a takeaway store. And my parents never lost faith in me. Like, that is the, like, I don't know if there's a greater irrigation system you could ask for.
Yeah.
Because even when there was no reason to water me, they still did.
I love that.
It's working out pretty well. This is a pretty good metaphor. No, but again, there was no reason because I think a lot of parents, and I mean this.
You were a pear tree.
Yeah. But I think a lot of parents at this point would have been like, hey, if you don't get your shit together, we're turning off the water supply.
Yeah.
They kept supplying me with water in the form of financial support, in the form of emotional support, in the form of they believed in me. And it's so crazy, man. But you hear people who are successful talk about this all the time. You always hear, when no one else believed in me,
yeah.
when the world looked down on me and spat on me, you believed in me. And every time they're doing this, they're crying.
Yeah.
Right. And even saying this makes me feel emotional, yeah. but it's like I had the ultimate irrigation system. Mm. Even though I was the weakest tree and the tree had the smallest odds of ever growing to having any fruit, they just went, we're going to keep watering this one. We feel sorry for this. We're going to keep watering it. Like, it's a little bit weird, but we're going to keep watering it. And dude, that has definitely been, I think, a competitive advantage that I had.
I love that. I love that there's a key point here as yeah. well. And I resonate with it as well. Is the unwavering belief of somebody.
Just somebody. In your life, right? It doesn't even have to be rational, bro.
No.
Because it wasn't rational when they believed in me.
It means so much to people.
Oh, dude.
And even when I think back to the most pivotal moments of my life as well, it's the exact, like when you were saying that, I just had flashes of people that were just like against the odds. Like if I was about to get kicked out of school, like speaking to one of my friends, my friend Jim, his mum Wendy, she was one of the teachers, one of the aides at the school. And she would always be like, it's all right. You know, you got this. You're smart. You just got to keep going at it. You know, you're not a piece of shit. It's like nearly that when you deep down feel it. And somebody gives you that. Like, my mum was the same. Like, there was nothing there to prove that anything was going to play out well.
Yeah.
But it was just unwavering belief for some unknown reason that it would work out. And I think after a while, I just started believing it.
Mm.
You know, like, even though the world was like, all the indicators are saying it's not working out right now.
This is a bad pear tree.
this is a horrible pear tree.
One of the worst pear trees ever.
So, there's maybe some analogy. There's some specialness in here, right? Like, being a shit pear tree with a lot of belief or like support can maybe make...
Well, don't forget, there's a luck component that comes into play here too.
For sure.
Because there are many pear trees out there that have the ultimate watering system, irrigation system, but still fail to fruit.
Yeah.
Right? And I think it's because there are so many other elements. Mm-hmm. So many others. Mm. You've had incredible people too, right? Yeah. So you just spoke about Wendy, your mum. Mm. What other forms of, whether it be irrigation or gum trees, in your life have helped you along the way?
I think us growing up in Australia and the time that we grew up in is a pretty big irrigation system there.
Oh, dude.
Like, I think about the
time. I think that is not irrigation system. I think that's the soil. There's the soil that we were planted in. Again, massive. Let's keep the analogy making sense here because you went back to that one, which is weird.
Yeah.
The soil in which we were planted in,
yeah.
the country we were born in.
Yeah. Huge.
Dude, huge.
Well, imagine like my grandparents and stuff, they grew up in Africa.
Yeah.
In East Africa. Like, do you ever imagine what your life would be like, say, if your parents still lived in Vietnam?
My mum reminds me all the time.
Yeah.
She always says to me that if you were born in Vietnam, you'd be looking after cows. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
She goes, that's what you'd be doing.
Yeah.
You'd be looking after cows.
Yeah, like it's – I think the timing as well when you hit a country at the right time too. Oh, like if you think about it, like we both arrived in Australia at a time where it was like opening up.
1980s.
Right? Like late 80s. I don't know. Mine was like 1991. When were you?
81.
Like –
parents arrived in 81. I arrived in 86.
Yeah,
I was born in 86, right?
How'd you arrive here before you were born? I'm like you're way older than But it's like we sort of came around that time, right?
Yeah.
When it was finally being opened up to, call it, Asian countries. Like, Australia wasn't like that in the 60s.
Well, it would have been a very different upbringing.
Very different.
Yeah, 20 years earlier.
But we got the support network of, like, a health system, an education system, you know, all these opportunities. The other thing as well that's amazing about Australia, it's like it's a small population but quite progressive.
Mm.
So if you even think about like the competitive landscape that we were up against versus say growing up in like, you know, a much larger country, like growing up in say China or the US or somewhere.
Yeah.
Like I always think about that too. Like I grew up in a small town where I could build confidence. Because the reality was, like, not many other people were sort of hunting in the same areas that I was either.
Mm.
Like, that competitive nature, like, I was able to feel a lot more, like, smarter than what I actually probably was.
Mm.
You know, and it builds you this unfounded levels of confidence again. You get these little bits of validation that you probably just wouldn't have gotten if you were born somewhere else.
Mm.
And the support network required too. So, I think, yeah, where we were born, where we grew up.
Plays a huge component.
Yeah.
And it just makes me think as well that... by being planted in this soil, if you don't take advantage of that, it almost feels like a crime. Because how many people don't get the opportunity to be planted in this wonderful soil and wished for it.
Mm.
So if you have that advantage, my goodness, do something with it.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like a responsibility that you've got to do something with it, because the number of people that would trade places with you just based on the place you were born.
Yeah. Well, that's the other part that this book really got me thinking about, is like opportunity. You know, we spoke a little bit when ideas come knocking on your door.
Yeah.
Like, and this is what maybe frames the word luck.
Yeah.
Right? So you get lucky with an idea.
Mm.
Do you then accept it or not?
Yeah.
I think there's also a skill set in terms of being able to identify opportunities and knowing when to strike.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? And that maybe doesn't get trained too much. And I want to jam on this because I feel like we have not an innate ability, but I think we're aware to opportunities. Mm-hmm. We have a sensitivity to opportunities when they arise. And I think we're able to extract value out of those opportunities when they come our way. Whereas I see at times people that probably have a very similar type of opportunity,
mm-hmm.
but they're not able to sort of, even if they do identify it, it's like, how do I actually then leverage this into my favor? And what that then looks like in terms of being practical advice and how you actually develop that a little bit more.
Well, there was the example in the book of Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
Versus, I think it was Chris Langen.
Yeah, yep.
Chris Langen and Oppenheimer, both geniuses. I love this bit. Yeah, and they spoke about how with Oppenheimer, he was able to end up in the end create the atomic bomb. One of the people, they just made a movie about him recently, right?
Yeah.
Whereas Chris was also a genius.
Yeah, arguably smarter.
Arguably smarter.
Yeah.
And the thing about Oppenheimer was he actually tried to kill one of his professors.
Yeah.
So like he had a lot of odds stacked against him because not only was he not as smart as Chris, he tried to kill someone and they just, oh, it's all good. Yeah, it's you fine. Know, you try to kill me. Good one, good one.
You get away with that.
Yeah, get away with that. Yeah, that was kind of weird.
Yeah.
But it was interesting because it's in their approach to the knock.
Yeah.
It's certain skills that they had, one had and one didn't. One had more IQ.
Yeah.
100% arguably had more IQ. Chris was smarter, right? Whereas I think Oppenheimer had IQ, but he had also what Malcolm Gladwell calls practical intelligence.
Yeah. I love that concept of practical
intelligence. I love that concept of practical intelligence. And I think that's what you're teasing at, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And going back to practical intelligence, like one of the big notes that I wrote, it's like one's ability to be able to make the world work in their favor.
Yeah.
Right? So it goes beyond just being smart.
Yeah.
It's how do you communicate what you want? How do you communicate your needs? How do you assess different opportunities?
Okay.
Right?
Let's jam on it.
Let's jam on it.
So what do you think? What do you think allows you to be able to assess the situation? I mean, I can kick us off if you want.
You kick us off.
Because I think situational awareness is huge.
Yeah.
And what is situational awareness, if you think about it pragmatically? It's being able to take a syntopical view of a situation very quickly. Yeah. It's when you're in a situation, but instead of being obsessed about the one thing, you can take a broad and wide view of the situation very quickly. You can go, okay, I understand that this is currently happening in the business, but I know what's happening in marketing. I know what's happening in accounting. I know what's happening in ops. I know what's happening in admin. And because you have that ability to look broad and fast, you can make decisions better than when you're in a silo. So I think the ability, and then you have this ability really, really well fine-tuned, is you can come into a situation, it's chaos. You can walk into that chaos, Ali, and you can go, okay, I see what's going on there. I see what's going on there. I see what's going on there. This is the way forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sum it up.
Sum it up. Sum it up and can turn all of that information into a directive piece of action.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas for most, it's come in chaos. Oh my God. Oh shit. Mm-hmm. What's happening over here? Oh, well, oh no, this is even worse. Oh, this is even worse. And then panic.
Mm-hmm.
And then as a result, if they make a decision, it's often wrong. And when they train themselves enough times in doing that, they go, well, I'm going to do what's safe. And when chaos happens, I'm going to do nothing. So indecision becomes a habit that most people inherit, I think, because they don't know how to approach these situations.
It's huge, just that word, sum it up.
Right? Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. There you go.
And
sum it up.
And if you don't sum it up and you go into, because life's full of uncertainty.
Yeah.
Right? And if you go in there and you don't have that ability to sum it up, you're going to get burnt.
Absolutely.
And when you see chaos, it scares you.
Yeah.
The more times you get burnt and there's more uncertainty, it's going to be like, I need to just play it safe right now.
And then you make no decision, indecision.
And it probably links back to that. You know, maybe there's a correlation there. If there's something holding you back, it might just be that. It's you've gone into uncertain situations. You've been hurt.
Burned before.
You've been burnt. And then there hasn't been a follow-up to rebuild that confidence to go back into that arena again.
Think about human behavior, right?
Yeah.
When you failed a math test when you were young,
yeah.
Did you ever look back to see why you failed? No. I mean, I didn't. Did you?
No. A little bit, yeah.
Oh, you did?
A little bit.
Wow, yeah. Okay. I never did. I don't know how many of the listeners can relate.
Yeah.
But the moment my teachers gave me back an F, yeah. When they gave me an F, so I'm like, F that, I don't care.
So you were just
I never want to see it again.
So you didn't...
Well, because you're not going to be tested on those topics again after that in school.
Yeah.
If we just did a semester of calculus, the next semester is on algebra.
Yeah.
So if I failed calculus, I just think, well, I'm not going to do it again. So who cares? Right? So the idea that I'm trying to say here is when you fail in life, you can't think, well, who cares?
Yeah.
Because life's going to come back around next week and you're going to be tested again. So you that's why I said in the mastery formula in the beginning of the episode is you have to review and reflect. So if you have been burned before, you need to sit down and go, well, why was I burned? You know what? I was burned because I panicked. I allow the emotions to get... What are you going to do next time? I need to find ways to stay calm during chaos. Maybe I'll focus on my breathing. Maybe I'm going to correctly learn how to label the emotions, identify them, and then breathe my way through it. Do you know what I mean? And then the next time that happens, you act on those new tools you've developed.
For sure. And the reason why I said yes to like, because I hated school for the most part. But one of the things that school teaches you is it gives you an immediate feedback loop, right? Whether it's right or wrong on what you're learning. Like if you think about real life, no one sits there and it's like, hey, like right now, hey, Ali, oh, your work's great. Or this is a tick of the box.
97.
Where you're like,
well done. Ahead. Yeah, yeah. Great marketing campaign. 97 points.
The beautiful thing about that is that you get this continuous feedback loop and it gives you the opportunity to figure out, like, because if you think about a test, the way that I always viewed it was this is a game. And the game is at the end of the day, there's a concept or a body of knowledge that's been put into some sort of package. And based on how I can decode that and understand it or memorize it or whatever it's going to be and put it back, I'm going to get a feedback loop that gives me a score in that game. So I always wanted to know if I'd put in some effort. If I didn't put any effort and I thought the thing was pointless and I don't really care anyway, who gives a shit? You know, we'd move on. I'd miss so many. Like, we actually found my reports, me and Chantel, when we were reading
house.
Yeah,
you sent me photos.
And it was hilarious. Like, you reading that through and it was like, Shan's like, they just hated you, you know? But it was always like, has potential, is disruptive.
Didn't
come for 12 weeks. When he did come, it was okay, you know? Like, it was, and I'm like, all right, wow, like, it wasn't a good story. But I remember, though, back then when I did actually put in effort, I always wanted to know why it went well or why it didn't.
Wow.
And, yeah, it was one of those things because I think that's how real life works. And the more inquisitive we are, and we try to develop our understanding of why certain things happen and why they don't. Because I think there's also an element here where most people, we're just too scared to face the truth.
Yes.
Right? Of, hey, my life at the moment is actually shit because of this, this, and this. It's much easier just to cast blame on some uncertain or unknown consequence. You know, it's like, I'm just not that person or things are just never really good for me anyway. And no matter how hard I try, it'll never get better. There's usually actually some specific reasons, you know, and we don't want to sit in that discomfort for long enough to actually be like, hey, I'm actually not that good at this, or I actually didn't try that hard at this, or there's other information here that I just don't currently have access to that I need to go get. And that does help speak that language, I think, of practical intelligence, is people that have practical intelligence, they leverage whatever they can around them, right? Like, they genuinely do. Like, even if they play it super humble and it might look like it's effortless, they're attuned, highly sensitive to when something happens, I'm onto that and I'm going to extract as much knowledge, value, connection, good feelings. And they do that over and over again over a long period of time.
Yeah.
Right? So, when you look at your list of luck, I can guarantee your list of lucky things that happen to you is probably going to be a lot higher than the average person. And it won't be because you were predestined to be lucky. Mm-hmm. It will be more so that you probably had a higher level of practical intelligence, mm-hmm. situational awareness,
yes.
to be able to take those opportunities when they came your way, right? And that was probably linked to the fact that you grew up in a country and an environment where you're probably given more of those. Yes. So whichever ones you got, you probably got a higher volume of them and you probably grabbed more of them, right? Whereas some people, they might not, depending on where they live or where they grow up, that volume might be a little bit lower. Mm. But this, the same sort of mentality probably still applies.
I mean, one thing that you made me think of while you were saying that is that you need to understand your impact in an environment. And I think that's EQ.
Yeah.
I know we've spoken about this a couple of times, but it's practical intelligence is emotional intelligence.
For sure.
Because when you're dealing with people, people are emotional. Mm. And if you can really read the room, read the situation, read the people, and you start to notice that when I do this, they kind of react negatively. I'm going to pull back on that. I'm going to go down the other way. Oh, this is getting a positive reaction. I'm going to keep going with this. And I think that's what Oppenheimer had over Chris.
For sure.
Whereas Chris, you know, the pure intellect, it's that pure archetype of I'm the smartest person in the room. What you're saying is wrong. I'm correct. That person often doesn't get very far.
It's because one-dimensional.
Everyone thinks they're a dick.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, yeah, he's smart, but he's a dickhead. Yeah. I hate him. Right? So I think we know that archetype exists in reality.
Yeah.
So you want to be that person who's... You may not be as smart, but because you know how to work your way around society, you understand the rules, and you know your impact on the environment that you're in. So I think it's about that sensitivity to your own actions in the environment. Mm. So when I do this, that happens. Huh, okay, I need to readjust the behavior to do this. Mm. To give you a communication example, one of the reasons why when I was younger, I grew up speaking quietly was because when I speak quietly at school, the bullies would leave me alone because I'm invisible. And if I play small and I play a small body, with smaller body language, people notice me less. And if people notice me less, the bullies don't see me as much, I don't get beat up. So then it was a learned behavior to be small because I was sensitive to my environment. So I thought growing up, one of the reasons why I believe I have EQ is because I got bullied heaps. And because of being bullied a lot, I had to learn how to be so sensitive to the environment because when I do this and talk like this and act like this, I'm invisible. When I do this, I'm seen, I'm dangerous, and I'm going to get hurt. It's just that I think for some people, they learn those behaviors. It served them while they're in school, but those behaviors follow them into adulthood and they don't have a new feedback loop in life to tell them that, hey, you don't need to do that anymore. No, you know, the Jordan Minor brothers aren't going to come around the corner and beat the shit out of you, right?
Yeah.
They're gone, right? They're not going to do that. So I think the next part that I want to say is the feedback loop is the very thing that helps you develop that sensitivity. Because life doesn't give you a, hey, Ali on the last Future Golf marketing campaign, 100%, buddy, high distinction, well done. Yeah. Oh, you smart little boy. You don't get that.
Yeah.
So you have to have your own feedback loop.
Mm.
And for some, it's journaling. For me, it's the mastery cycle. And when I think about how I journal, Ali, it's literally the mastery cycle. Mm. I tried and applied this year, the first 3 months of my life. How did you live then? Okay, tried and applied it. Hey, you know what? I'm feeling a little more stressed than usual. Okay, well, review and reflect on that. Why are you feeling more stressed than usual? Okay, right now, you need to start investing in more non-correlated assets in life because you have a lot of your investments in your business. Sometimes if the business is going up and down, your mood is so attached to the ups and downs of business. Okay, if you had more non-correlated assets to your business, you're going to feel better. Well, how are you going to plan to improve? All right, I'm going to start investing in more non-correlated assets. But you see what I mean? I'm creating for myself a feedback loop for life. And I think that's one of the ways to start developing practical intelligence is have a feedback loop going. And if you're unhappy right now, well, don't just feel unhappy. Review and reflect why. What can you do differently? And go try it.
Love that. The big thing that stood out for me there is something you said there. And I've seen it just pop up a little bit over the last couple of weeks.
Mm.
And it's nearly like an instruction or like an omen nearly, right? Mm. It's about learn how to see.
Okay. Wow. Right? I love that phrase.
And that's when you were talking, that's exactly it. You have an attuned ability to see.
Mm.
Right. When you think about situational awareness, I think a lot of the times our eyes are open. It's a bit like listening, right? Our eyes are open, but we're not truly seeing.
Okay.
We're not paying attention to body language.
Yeah.
We're not paying attention to the different sounds. We're not paying attention to what's going around.
Mm.
And if you can hone that ability to see and to be aware of the signals,
yes,
the opportunities, the threats, the strengths that you have, and you're able to combine that, you know, it's nearly how do you then refine that ability to see, right? And I think a lot of that, it's just attention. It's like having intention to actually see and look for things.
Not being afraid of the truth. That's not being afraid to see the truth too. Yeah.
And all of it, right? But also the world.
Mm.
Like those that, like even if you think about the greatest like entrepreneurs and the greatest artists, what do people always say about them? Say they're visionaries, right? It's literally linked to that.
Seeing.
You know, they could see something two steps ahead.
Yeah.
They could, you know, they're able to see the world differently and then they reimagined it. It's like that is a skill set that no one ever really speaks about. It's just observing and seeing it so deeply, right? Like there's this thing in Melbourne at the moment, this Da Vinci Loom exhibition. And it was one of the biggest things that I took from that, where Da Vinci's mastery was just curiosity and then really seeing. Like he would spend a year or two just studying anatomy, right? He would just look at things and he would see. And I think the same was with Monet. You know, you just have these, he had his block of land. It would just sit there and you would just paint it with detail and like just see it. And it's like at some point, if you spend that much time just seeing and going that deep into it, like I think Einstein was probably pretty similar. You would just sit there and, you know, essentially meditate on problems and try to look at the world in such a different way and then would unlock all this great insight. It's like we nearly need to just allocate time just for awareness.
Yeah.
And to see, and then that's maybe how you build that situational awareness. But I love what you said there too, as well as like, if you've got feedback loops, like I was thinking back too, like I grew up in a pretty small town, right? I was the only Indian kid within probably like 10 kilometers at that time as well. And you're navigating. And I remember the first school when I moved up there, I probably didn't play it right. You know, I didn't adapt to that environment in the way that I need to. And it didn't really work. I was never able to really crack that group and do that. But I remember when, because that was like grade four, I remember going into high school, taking those feedback loops where I was, say, maybe getting fights or not fitting in or doing all these things and being like, all right, well, I can actually control this a little bit more than rather than just being a victim of this and being like, hey, it's because I'm different. That's why these things are happening. And I think subconsciously that became my game in high school. It's like, well, how do I actually navigate this essentially as a little bit of an outsider, but still work it into, you know, my favor in a sense and have all that because I was small and I was different. It's like a brutal combination when you're heading into year seven into a school with like 1,300 kids. But it's like, well, can I use humor? Can I help out the bullies here, so I like
can
have
I work
that.
For them?
Can I like, can you navigate, right? And you learn that, like in school, such a great ecosystem.
Such a crazy ecosystem, right? Yeah.
And you end up figuring out, it's like, okay, well, I've got the smart kids, I've got the bullies, I've got these guys, I've got my crew, I've got that. And it's like, and then you have that sort of melting pot of how you
Well, that's why I think as well, they say that a lot of the times, not all the time, but I think more often than not, the kids who are extremely popular during high school, later on in life have it harder because the kids who weren't as popular had to really develop that situational awareness and practical intelligence and emotional intelligence, whereas the other kids were just given attention. And maybe you won the genetic lottery and you're beautiful. Yeah. You're given the attention. And that's not to take away from the hard work that beautiful people still do, but that's why you hear more stories of, oh, it's unexpected. How did this person become? How was that even? It's because the journey of adversity gives you an extra few tools that become extremely beneficial. And the book talks about this too.
Yeah.
It's that those advantages that you get, if you get them early, they serve you for your entire life. Right? It's that you being able to navigate the school grounds of the bullies and maybe I should be a little more friendly with them, make them laugh a little more, means they'll like me more. That even as a skill set has compounding interest throughout your entire life.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting as, you know, we unpack that kind of topic of, that practical intelligence.
Yeah. And it's an openness to change, right? Because the counter to that is like, oh, well, I'm just going to stick with my tribe, the people that are like me, everyone else can go screw themselves. And it was just never really going to work. And I think you end up getting such a limited view of the world that way.
You do. That right. happened to me, Ali. Right. Growing up in high school, I had this mindset of, I'm only going to hang out with the Asians.
Yeah.
And I remember when I made my first Caucasian friend, I was like, whoa, sandwiches, man. Yeah. Damn, this is amazing. Vegemite and butter, yeah. football. Whoa, this is so fun. Whereas like Asians is packet noodles and, yeah. you know, series and yeah. Like I was never exposed to it. Oh, wow, Pink Floyd. What the frick? All I listened to is R&B. Wow. Yeah. So I was exposed to a whole new world of things. Yeah. And but it's funny, you're right though. We get a bit tribey.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that it's something that we probably don't do enough is going into uncertain situations and just then seeing how am I going to navigate this. Like I love it as well. Like even as I got older, like I'd love going to like a conference and then just getting a real quick lay of the land. Because you know when you go on like a 3-4 day conference. It is like it becomes an eco. Cool
it's a, becomes it's a an high ecosystem, school, it's high right?
It becomes an ecosystem in itself. It's
yeah,
like
yeah, that's interesting.
Know, like there's so quickly with all these strangers, organic like power dynamics form. There's like there's a fun group that's going to do all the fun activities.
Yeah, true, true. There's the bullies.
There's like the speakers. Yeah. It's like you get in with the speaker group that are, they've got all the influence that everyone wants.
That's
saying.
Me. That's, yeah, that was me.
Yeah, so, you're that guy. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, but there's like an ecosystem that happens there. But that can be crippling, right? The first couple of times you do that.
Oh, absolutely.
Where it's like, oh, I'm just going to sit in the corner and just, again, similar mentality, just...
I'll be
don't
invisible.
Draw attention.
I'll just be invisible.
Let's get through this, you know, and then go back. But after a while, it's like there's nearly a beauty in actually saying, well, how can you gamify this and what can you unlock just by trying to play that? And what opportunities does that then unlock as well? It's probably the fundamentals of networking, right? The best networkers, again, have an innate ability to know who are the people in there that are going to align with what they're trying to do the best. At the highest level of impact. And they can identify that really quickly, even in very large groups of people.
Yeah. Again, that's situational awareness. You throw them into a situation, I immediately can assess the situation and identify the optimal path.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I get this question a lot teaching communication skills, okay? So as I teach communication, I teach you how to use your voice in different ways. People go, okay, Vin, so I'm a dentist. And when I'm with an angry patient, and they're angry because their son was being naughty in the room. How should I use my voice in that situation? And then I'll get another question. Vin, I'm a lawyer and I'm in court and the situation is I'm losing the argument. How specific? And when I get questions like this, this is just give me the fish, Vin.
Yeah.
Vin, give me the fish.
I just want
to
eat.
Whereas what I'm trying to promote in all of my classes now, and I think even in this podcast, is don't ask for fishes. Learn how to fish.
Yeah.
And the way you learn how to fish is you go through the mastery cycle. So that dentist will go, okay, I've got an angry patient because of the kid. I'm just going to try something with my voice. I'm just going to try it. Review and reflect. Okay, that didn't work. Okay, I brought way too much joy to that conversation when I didn't read the room well. I came into it like, hey, it's okay. Don't you, all kids are like this. And that got a negative reaction. Shit, okay, I made it too crazy. What am I going to do to improve? All right, next time I'm gonna match them where they're at. So they're frustrated. I want to come in with a little more frustration too and empathize. Try it. That worked. Oh, my God. When you become proficient at creating your own feedback loops, you will now know how to fish. You will now be able to develop your own situational awareness. You now no longer ask people for fish. You go out and you fish your own fish.
Love that.
So again, I'm just saying to make that really pragmatic, if you want to develop that situational awareness, you're going to have to go out there and get it wrong. Otherwise, you're going to need someone like me or you or someone who is good at reading situations to be on call at all hours of the day, all your life. Or you can get really good at it yourself by going out and just trying.
It's reps.
It's just reps. This is what the book has also discovered, right? That was the premises of the 10,000-hour rule, that the violinists from the greatest music school in Berlin, the greatest ones, spent 10,000 hours. In other words, they had the most reps.
And I think if somebody's sitting there and they're listening and they're like, oh, well, that's just not how my brain works. I don't have the ability to like, you know, have a syntopical approach and just sum things up like that.
Right.
I think the solution to that is you have to put yourself into uncertain situations. You need a diversity of situations to give you that. Because even when I look back, again, another gift that I got from my parents, at the time it may not have felt like a gift, but there was so much, there was such a high level of like uncertainty and chaos being created just based on how like my dad lived.
Yeah.
That realistically, by the time I was 13, I'd seen such a wide gamut of things and
exposure.
What the boundaries were, you know, and how ridiculous stuff could actually get before it breaks. And what that looks like and how you have to then negotiate it from that position. But by the time I was like 13, 14, 15, there wasn't really all that much that could rattle me in terms of it.
You're more resilient.
If someone's like, oh, we're going to turn off your power. For most kids, that would be like, what? What do you mean you're going to turn off?
That would have been me.
That's going to be really scary, right? Like I've had power my whole life. I'm like, no, I just got to call them up, just renegotiate it, get some terms.
And you're 12.
You know, like, and I do that. It's like, it's better if a kid calls as well because then they're definitely not going to turn it off. Yeah. You know, like you learn all these things.
Dude, I would have freaked out. How am I going to play Mario on my Nintendo?
No, the first time it's like, all right, you got to light some candles and all that. But then the next time, you start, but you learn that nearly in those environments. But again, it's what perspective do you have on it? You know, there's two different ones. One is, that was the most traumatic thing and it's ruined me for the rest of my life. The other was, it was actually a great learning experience and it helped me form a skill set. Like I was gifted this learning opportunity to navigate so many uncertain situations and then be able to move forward for it. So I think it's also perspective. You know, think about a lot of the times the things that even say if we've got a victim type of mentality, if you can sit there and actually dig deeper and be like, well, what did I actually learn from that? What gifts did I get from that bad shit that happened to me? It's usually what forms a lot of our strengths.
Well, Lee, that's why I created the step two in the mastery process is review and reflect. You have to review and reflect on what did you learn from that? Because if you just keep doing things but never learn from it, then you're actually... I mean, I think another reason why people don't just... do it, like Nike says too. I think one of the reasons why people don't do it is because they've tried it and it doesn't work. And then they've tried the exact same approach and it doesn't work. And they've tried the exact same approach and it doesn't work. So then they come to the conclusion, I can't do it. Where it's like, no. That same method you've tried three times in a row, that doesn't work. It's not you can't do it. It's you did the same method three times. You just did them faster. That doesn't work. And I think that's what people need to hear clearly from the message is that it's not that you're not capable, it's that your approach did not get the result that you want. So what do? Change the approach. But before you change the approach, you have to extract what lessons you've learned from the failed approach to formulate your new approach. And it's simple as that. It's simple as that, right?
That's true.
Yeah. So I think it's really about don't fool yourself. You've got to be so careful in this journey in life to fool yourself into thinking, nah, this is not possible for me. I can't do this. I can't do that.
Yeah.
You're tricking yourself. You're fooling yourself out of an incredible life.
And to be honest, it's an excuse. It's an unnecessary excuse.
It is.
It's just going to hold back like potential. It's such a potential killer.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
And here's my kind of gripe with it too, right? It's like, I have this thing in my head, Ali, where I just think there are useful beliefs and then there are useless beliefs. Like, let's say, for example, if I believe that I'm tall and that makes me feel more confident and I'm able to live a life that where I do more, and people are like, nah, he's not tall. Have you seen basketballers? They're way taller than him. Vince's actually really short, right? Like, who's the judge of that? So, well, I'm just going to believe that I am. And this is also the beginning steps of being delusional. But I think in order to live an amazing life, you need a little bit of that.
Yeah. You've got to kind of lean towards delusion a little bit.
You need to.
If you're going to go into the imaginary world and like the thing that is outside the norm, there has to be a level of... it's like Elon Musk, right?
Yeah.
Like for most people, if they said we're going to go to Mars, it's pretty delusional.
Pretty delusional.
Right? But he's done enough. Like, whatever the combination
is. No, he's got
to. People kind of believe it. Maybe, now it's been a while and, we haven't really gotten to Mars
yet. I definitely believe it now, though.
It's like, all right, well, how do you then actually... Like, delusion's fine as long as you bridge the gap towards it somehow.
Yeah, we're strong. Right?
Like, it's only delusional if you just keep talking about it, but there's nothing happening to move you towards it.
Yeah, true.
Right.
Your actions don't match your level of ambition.
Yeah. I love a little bit of delusion.
Well, but this is my kind of this is my thesis, right? Let's say that I believe in my life, I can achieve anything I desire. That's a really useful belief for me, because in believing that, Ali, I've been able to build the life that I live right now. Whereas if I had the limiting belief of, oh no, I can, like, I'm just going to, like, for the rest of my life, be an accountant, I'll be a bookkeeper, or I'll be an accountant or a CPA or something. Nothing wrong with those careers. But for me, if I believe that was it for me, then that's all I'd be doing. Mm. And I always go back to this argument. When I die, and we do discover that there is some kind of being up there, some kind of God, and that person says, oh, you've preached the wrong thing. Anything isn't possible, you idiot. Yeah. I don't really care, because I'm still glad I lived my life in this way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I wouldn't have lived the life that I lived if I didn't have that useful belief. Yeah. So I guess as we round out this kind of part of it, I think it's important to have useful beliefs and audit some of your beliefs. If you've got some useless beliefs, get rid of them. Yep. Especially the one where it's like, I'm not capable. I can't do X. I can't do Y. I can't do Z.
Yeah.
Dude, I saw one of the I saw a post the other day that there was the archer that shot the longest archery shot, had no freaking arms.
Yeah, wow.
Shot it with his legs.
What?
But you know what I mean? Yeah, it's like, I saw a picture of that and I went, you see, that is a classic example of, if he grew up thinking, well, archery is only for people who has arms. Mm. We wouldn't have got a world record from someone who doesn't even have bloody arms. No. So it's that whole mindset. It's just, it fascinates me.
Yeah.
And now, you know, we're heading into our 40s, bro. Yeah. I've got a pocket full of really useful beliefs that serve me.
Mm.
And if it's useless, man, I ain't got time for that now.
It's, love it.
Yeah. All right.
That was a cool jam.
That was a cool jam.
All right. So we spoke a little bit about kind of the frameworks of...
Well, we talked about the irrigation systems. Yeah. We talked about... But is there any more in the irrigation systems for you? Was there anything else in terms of the invisible strings of success, the invisible elements that help the success become successful?
Yeah, for sure. So I think the one that I now lean towards a little bit more is, what were the things that were happening in the times where we were in our prime or whatever? You know, so they talk about that in the book a little bit.
Mm. Aren't we in our prime now?
No, but like, say, for example, like, with Bill Gates. So they go back and they say that around that tech boom, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, like all of the key sort of Silicon Valley people of that era, they were born within a 1 year period.
Yeah. Right? In the 1950s.
They grew up in like America and
California. Was it 1930s or 1950s?
They were born in the 50s, mid 50s. Right?
Well, that's like, for the tech boom, right. But then the Rockefellers were around the 30s, right?
Yeah. And then there was like the 1860s was another time. Like there were these peak periods of times that if you're born within that 1 or 2 year gap, it just unlocks so many more opportunities at that outlier level, right? So I think back to that and I wonder, like,
we were born in the 80s.
You know, like, not saying that we're outliers like that, but I wonder what things were happening, because you and me are born within about 6 months of each other.
Yeah.
Right? So like, what similar things were happening in that key moment? And I think he talks back and it's like sort of-
Bro, the internet.
So it's like 21. When we were 21 to 23.
Yeah.
Because that's the peak time that he says in the book.
Yeah.
He's like, when you're about- 21 to 24, you're not old enough where you've got too many fixed beliefs and jaded, but you're still not too young enough where you don't have the mind. You've got the right level of energy and optimism and time and all that.
Look at the two businesses we run.
Yeah. I think it wasn't the internet. I think for us, it was social media.
Well, that is the internet, dude.
No, but there's the internet.
It captures that.
But there's the internet. But I think the big thing that happened to us around 2000, when we were sort of around early 20s.
Okay.
Right? Like, and I was sort of digging this down a little bit more, right? Yeah, so if I think about like what that intersection again of success was, well, we had a developed skill set for when that fruit had flowered that we could then leverage a little bit more.
Yeah.
And I think what was happening around 2004, 2006, and we were sort of around 2021, that's when social media started. That's 100%. When Facebook was starting, right?
Yeah.
And then I think about e-commerce sort of having then its moment, like, but low entry barrier e-com is kind of where we both started.
Yeah.
You know, you had Magic Online, at a golf club and community. But these things cost us like $100, $50 to get started.
Yeah.
Whereas 10 years prior to that, 20 years prior, we would have had to take a loan. Mm-hmm. We would have had to do all these other things to do it.
We wouldn't have been able to get the loan.
What?
The idea would have knocked and we wouldn't have been able to open the door.
There was a, like, when I look back as well at my entrepreneurial part of my journey, if it wasn't a combination of being able to build a website really quickly without any development skills.
Yeah.
And be able to set up Facebook ads super easy, the whole thing probably doesn't really take off.
Yeah.
Right? But I was ready for that because sort of mid-20s,
yeah, prime time.
That was a game that was quite playable, right? At the same time, you've got the books that were coming out, like the 4-hour work week. How do you work differently? How do you think a little bit differently? How do we escape the 9-to-5? You know, that was all happening. So I think back to these intersections that were happening, you know, because we were probably in that first, we were at the start of the generation as well, where like maybe the corporate structure isn't the only way, right? And then I think also to what you've done, it's like you were primed for content creation.
Mm.
Like before anyone else was even thinking about it, your best mate was a videographer.
Yeah.
You know, and you guys were like looking at production and you were already making videos for your magic that you were doing. So you're already like steps ahead.
Mm.
And then all you had to do, like realistically after that, it was distribution because your content game was already well ahead of everyone else.
Mm.
So think back to these little intersections. And like even now, like I think about the recent thing, like when Reels got big and TikTok got big, you're nearly, no one can really compete against what you were going to put out there in that environment.
Well, what's interesting is I think one of the reasons why I do well on those platforms is because I was recording terabytes worth of content since 2016.
Thousands and thousands of hours of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
You can use it in snippet form.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
Like who out there would even have that? Like if you think about it, how many people out there do you think have that much, as much produced content
as
what you would have?
Yeah, it's a good point.
Like, so you had this wealth of assets that you're probably sitting there and you went through the failure loops or the iterations for the first 5 years and you're like, why isn't this-
Nothing's working.
Right?
No one likes me.
The thing that changed though was the macro environment then aligned and matched up with your skill set.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
So that's a really interesting call out. I never thought about it as social media.
Maybe.
Well, I think it is. You're bang on. But I mean, I guess it's a part of the internet.
Yeah.
But it's 100%, dude.
Yeah. But the internet as well. Like, because the internet was the first
part of course, it. Of course.
Right? But because you start in that entrepreneurial journey with Encyclopedia Magic, then it gets to social media. But then while you're doing that, you're refining your communication skills through a keynote speaker. Like, it all kind of lined up. That now, like, if you actually trace it back, it's like, yeah, this makes sense.
Well, the dots connect looking back, right?
The dots connect looking back a little bit.
Right?
Like, I even think back to having a gut feel about golf, right? Like, right now, golf is pretty mainstream. It's having a pop culture moment. I could see that 10 years ago.
Wow.
Right? Like, I could 100% because I'm like, all that was happening back then, there was an invisible barrier, which was the elitism and the view that people had on golf.
I still sometimes have that view.
Right? Well, it still existed somewhat, right? But it was so closed back then that the idea of somebody under the age of 40 playing golf was just mind-blowing. People are not. But when you actually played it, because what the mismatch was for me is when you actually played it, how fun it was. So I'm like, once you get behind that wall,
it's super fun.
It's amazing.
I think that's one of the reasons why I still don't play.
Yeah.
It's because of that kind of mental barrier.
Yeah.
Is that I don't really look like that kind of demographic. Yeah. So I shouldn't really be playing that sport.
Now it's like, now if you, the picture of a golfer now when I look at it, it's like it nearly is now a 30-year-old. And it's so diverse and it's changing. You know, athletes have changed it. You know, artists have changed it.
I think future golf has changed it.
Yeah, things like having, you know, things like future golf have changed it. But it's like it was nearly primed for it because at the end of the day, younger people were going to need a leisure outlet at some point. Then you mix that in with more flexible types of working arrangements and how the world's changing. People wanting ways to experience nature because it's becoming limited. You know, like it was all going to sort of people needing greater connection for longer periods of time, but not really having avenues to do it. It makes a lot of sense why it's having a moment right now.
Interesting. You could see that 10 years ago.
Like, obviously not, you never see it to the way that it plays out, but the hypothesis is there. It's like, well
that's why if I like
it, but like mine was a lot more simpler. Mine was more like, if I like it, other people like me are going to like it.
Yeah. Well, mine was simple as, if communication skills changed my life, it's going to be able to change other people's lives. So I'm going to teach this thing. I'm going to teach it, right? See? It's simple as that.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting looking back on your life and not giving yourself credit for the success, but crediting the era you were born in, crediting the irrigation system, the trees that were around you. Yeah. It's actually a really humbling exercise.
It's a cool, like,
really cool exercise.
I wish we had more time to really map it out more.
Like, well, we got as much time as we want.
But, like, all the different people that, like, played a role.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and even thinking back on that, because you forget there'd be so many people,
man.
That, like,
so many.
And moments, or, like, seeing something or seeing a post that
I remember this, right? When I first started, like, speaking was a chapter of my life, bro. Mm. Like, I've been able to travel all around the world speaking to all the biggest companies that I had no real reason speaking to, right? And that all happened when I think about what was one of the trees that supported me. It was a man named David Griggs. Mm. And it was crazy because he saw me speak once and he just walked up to me. I didn't even know who this man was, and he freaked me out. And he goes, "You have something, man. You have something, young man. I want you to speak an event for me. Speak an event for me. Do it for free. Don't ask me why. Just rock up here, place, time, speak here." I was like, man, this man is freaky. And I was like, all right, I'll do it because I'll take risks. Yeah. I spoke, and it was a Rotary Club. So when I rocked up, I was like, what the hell? Everyone here is like 100 years old. Why am I speaking here? What have I done? I'm speaking at a retirement home. And then I was young and a little bit mean. So I spoke there anyway. Gave it my best shot. Yeah. And at the end of it, they all gave me a standing ovation. So I was like, oh, that's really nice. And then I learned that.
That's pretty great that they all stood.
Yeah.
That
would have been difficult. Yeah. But the crazy thing is that I found out they always give speakers standing ovations in Rotary Clubs. Like, that made me feel a little bit of shit. But the powerful thing that happened was that man, David Griggs, he arranged for a speaking agent to be in that room to watch me speak. And that agent flew in from interstate.
Wow.
And that agent got me my first speaking gig.
Amazing.
Was because of this man. So, like, that's ridiculous. Mm. If I never met David, never took the chance, the door knocked, he knocked on the door, and then when I finished that talk, I still remember, he introduced me to Scott, the agent, and he goes, "The stars have aligned, Vin. I knew they would align. It's aligned perfectly." I was like, man, this guy's crazy, but I love him. He changed my life. He was at my wedding as well. He changed my life, right? And it's, I could have not rocked up at that gig. A whole chapter of my life would not have opened. I would have never lived in the US. And then living in the US, bro, that gave me another series of advantages. I learned how to think like Americans think. Americans have this incredible mindset as well. So I wouldn't have achieved the things I've achieved in this chapter. So the butterfly effect of these little advantages you get along the way, whether it's luck, whether it's preparation, whether it's irrigation system, whether it's other trees, it's crazy because they compound like mad.
The coolest thing there too is, like, I love it. It's like that we have these magical moments. And the thing that came to my mind when you were saying that is when somebody randomly comes up to you and they see something in you, and then you decide not to act on that. That's where this thing happens, right? In all of these stories, and you hear that so often, where, like, somebody will, unbeknownst to you, why they appeared in your life, they'll come and say this thing, like, come into this thing, right? There's a version of you that would have been like, nah, I'm too busy, I don't want to do that. And a whole different pathway might not have unfolded.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It may have come through a different form.
Yeah, but it may not have.
It may not have, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But you were open to it.
I was.
I think the difference there is
openness. Had nothing else better gone for me.
But I think that's your mentality to life, though. Yeah. I think you lean towards being open to those knocks when they come.
I do.
I remember having, there's two that come to my mind as well. Like, one is when I was in it would have been like end of year 11, start of year 12, before it's final year of school. So pretty much, in the same week, I was told, hey, you should leave school and, like, go pursue a trade or something like that, because it's just not for you. It's not really working. In that same week, there was a careers teacher, Karen, that I was really close to. And I didn't even know this, but she applied because there was, like, a cutoff date to apply for universities and stuff like this. So this is, like, I'm pretty much one foot out the door.
Wow.
But you had to put in your applications and all this sort of stuff. Without me even knowing, she applied for me to go to university.
Oh, right. Really?
So she put in like 5-6 different things. As
for you?
Yeah. So set up the account, did all the things, put them in there. Right.
Oh, God.
Fast forward 6-7 months, I end up staying in school, studying a bit, getting a good enough mark.
Wow.
Open up the paper, get into university. And that unlocked like a whole different world for me.
Wow.
So it was like going from like, shit, do I just drink, hang out with my mates, do whatever we're doing, all the way like that little transformational moment. where somebody like, she's like, because she always used to be like, I see something in you, right? You just got to try a little bit harder or whatever and then go there. But like, yeah, like I look back at that moment, wow. Massive, right? That was one. The other one was when I was working early in my career at a really good friend of mine still to this day, Marg. Well, I still remember it being at the bottom of the steps and I was sort of stuck in the rut with this job that wasn't really going anywhere. Contract was about to end and all that. Mm. And it was just as simple as like, hey, I've been seeing you. I think you've got a lot of potential. You should do this and try to actually go for a better position here. It was just nearly that simple, right? And then we started talking. I'm like, oh, really? She's like, yeah, I'll do an intro with who's going to be the new boss. You guys should have a meeting and then go from there. That like one interaction completely changed like the next 4 or 5 years of my life.
Holy right? shit.
But then just being open to that and then being like, oh, yeah, maybe I should like. But somebody's seeing something that I couldn't even see at all. And just having a little bit of belief. And then take, and usually what they'll also do, the combination there is, it's like a little bit of belief. It feels unexpected, but then they also take one action for you.
Yeah.
It's like they give you one,
which
is like set up the meeting or
fly this person in
or whatever it is. And when you get that, it usually, like if I can probably look back 5, 6 different instances in my life where capturing that opportunity has completely transformed.
Man, you know what?
Same with Marg. This is the funniest part with Marg too. Marg is the one that invited me to go to a random conference in 2015 that I never should have gone to. And that's where I saw you speak.
That's where we fell in love.
That's it. And I was, that's the same thing as Griggs. I'm like, this young man has something special. It was probably, and you were probably at that gig because that was the first one that he would have done for you or something.
It was like, one of the first ones.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's like it compounds, right?
Dude.
So like,
I think we just found the through line between how we met each other. For you, it was through Marg. For me, it was through David.
Yeah, there you go.
Dude, how weird is that?
Crazy, huh?
But you know what it makes me think as well when I think of this? Something that Dan sent me, which I thought was really cool, from Adam Grant. Yeah. It's a quote. I'll read it.
Read it.
Narcissistic leaders are threatened by talent. They want to be the smartest person in the room. Humble leaders are drawn to talent. They surround themselves with people who make them smarter. Great leaders, however, grow talent. They strive to make everyone in the room smarter. And I think that's what people like David and Mark do. What they do is they grow the people around them. They don't just try to attract smart people and then utilize their smarts, right? They actually grow the people around them. I think that's the difference between an average leader and a great leader. And I think that's the difference between outliers and normal liars, right? Is that when you're an outlier, the mere fact that when you're around an outlier, bro, you grow and it's inevitable that you grow. I haven't really found that many outliers who are doing amazing things where when I'm around them, I'm diminished.
No.
I find that when I'm around great A players and people who are great at what they do, their energy alone is nourishing. Just by being in their aura, I get vitamin D.
It's always abundant. It's bigger.
It's abundant. It's bigger. And it makes you dream bigger, think bigger, live better, right? So it just made me think, we should do this and hold each other accountable to this. Why don't we pick one person in our own environment where we can be a David and a Mark for? And even to our listeners, like let's call each other out on this. Let's do it, right? And if you're listening to this, as much as you want that David and Mark to come into your life, right now in your life, you can actually be that for someone. Because like you said, all it requires is something that's unexpected, kind words, supportive words, paired with one single action. So why don't we do something like this, Ali, so that we can take one action from this pod and doing this and from having this discussion?
It's a pretty crazy formula. If that works. Yeah, I agree.
Why don't we do that?
I love it.
All right. We'll pick one person each after
and then
this.
We'll report back in
And we'll like report back in the next pod. Yeah, you'd be like, well, I ruined their lives, Ali. That was a great one.
Said it. They didn't do it.
But that's the thing. I think that's all that sometimes someone needs. Because when we reflect on that, isn't that crazy? Marg saying those words to you. Taking that one action, unexpected, change your whole life.
And how crazy is like the flow-on effect, right? Like if we go and like tip our hats to the Margs and the Davids.
Yeah.
It's like that then leads to, say, this podcast.
Yeah, I know.
And even if there's 5 listeners out there.
Yeah.
Maybe one of them might get a flow-on effect where
and they go do something.
And it goes and something happens, right? And then that just continues on.
Oh, dude, I'm so inspired.
The cool thing about the Margs and the Davids is I think that they're often under-celebrated.
They are.
You know, like because what happens And I think this is the thing, like when the word that came to me is I think they're champions of others,
mm.
right? So what they do is they champion people, and these people exist.
Yeah.
They're in most workplaces.
They're everywhere.
It's like that champion that no matter what, they just build everyone up.
Yeah.
They listen to everyone and they're like, hey, you know what? I'm going to introduce you to this person.
Yeah, you're amazing.
I'm going to do this for you. I'm going to do that, right? Like I remember my mum she was like that. She would go into a workplace, and even though she didn't have any power, she'd be like, "Oh, if somebody couldn't speak English, she's like, I'll write your resume for you, you know, and I believe in you. Like, you need to go for a better job. You need to do all these things, right?" And they're like these unheralded champions, but they shine that. Actually, what they do though, they never get the credit because they shine the light. Like, they'll gift that to somebody else, right? They'll give that to a Vin. You know, and
I'd love it.
And you're
like, yes, shine that light, shine more light on me.
But how important is it to nearly find these people? Or when you do, because I think because they don't get celebrated, we often aren't aware of them or we take them for granted, you know, and there's a real 100% importance in that. Like, I even remember like one of my mates, Greg, that I went to uni with, he was always such a champion. Like, no matter what group we were in, he'd be like, whoever it was, you could be the quietest person and he would just make this amazing story about you. Right. Now all of a sudden, like, everyone's like, I've got to chat to that person because like Greg's just like talked them up.
Wow.
You know, and he's always did that. But I think back to that as well. Like, there's a champion level of energy in there where you're opening it up. You know, like,
no, but here's the thing. Yeah. It doesn't take much to shine the light on others.
No.
And imagine being able to be a part of an outlier's journey.
Mm.
How cool is that?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Right? Yeah. And I think we all have that power. We all have that ability. And I think, sure, look for those people. When you have them, appreciate them. But also know that you can be that person for others. You absolutely can. And here's the tragic part, man. Sometimes we don't do that for the people that we even love most. So I think there's a bit of a... bit of an important thing there that we be a source of light in life, you know?
It's interesting, isn't it?
Because how many more outliers would there be in the world
if
we were a little less selfish? And it's not a difficult formula. I love it. Three things. Difficult. Unexpected.
Yeah.
Supportive words.
Yeah.
One action. I love that.
Yeah.
Dude, that's beautiful.
Cool.
No, that was nice.
That was
nice.
I like that.
That got a little bit deep.
I know, that was cool.
I love it. Something I wanted to bring up, the Matthew effect. It's, I mean, to define it, it's the law of cumulative advantage.
Yeah.
It's basically compounding interest. Yeah. However, it talks about compounding interest, not in the financial sense, in terms of, I think, traits. And when I think of the Matthew effect, I think of, as I've been able to develop my ability to communicate, that has been one of the greatest competitive advantages that I've ever had in my life. Because now, as a teacher, as a content creator, as an entrepreneur, I'm able to communicate my value with such precision that has allowed me to build really my dream life. And I think there are certain skills in life, and I'm curious to ask your opinion on this. What do you think are the top three skills that if you start to develop, it will give you this cumulative advantage that will follow you for the rest of your life? It's like, for example, some of this we can't control. Yeah. Being born in Australia, massive cumulative advantage.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Being born to having great parents, massive cumulative advantage. Yeah. But these things I can't control.
Yeah.
When it comes to skill development, what are the what are three controllables? I mean, I'm super biased, but I believe that once you can communicate well, oh man.
Yeah.
The sooner you learn it, the longer you're going to benefit from the advantages it's going to bring you.
Yeah, I think 100%. Because I think it's not only learning how to communicate, but it's also knowing it's figuring out what you want and how to communicate that as well. Yeah, the book talks about that, right? It says that people that come from, like, say, more advantaged parents or, like, say, even Western countries.
Versus Asian cultures.
Yeah.
We should talk about the airline thing. Right? That was really fascinating.
About authority, right? Like, there's a doctor example there where that young kid, he's like, goes into the doctor's office and he could just confidently speak to the doctor and demand respect because of the family that he's come from. That hit me so hard when I was thinking about our kids. And I'm like, just about raising them.
In what sense?
Like, around teaching them how to communicate clearly.
Right.
And to communicate, like, their wants and needs in a confident way. And to also be able to demand respect from a diverse group of people,
mm.
right? You don't really get taught that. Because how often are we with our kids? Like, be quiet, shush, we're here, respect adults, you know your place, do all that. There's actually also the counter there. It's like, my mum taught me all of that stuff when I was a kid. Like, I was the person that would go pay for the stuff. I was the person that would jump on the phone and call. I would do all these things. I think about that as a cumulative effect.
That's a good point. Same with me, because I was the only English-speaking person in the family. I'm always on the phone.
You then have to navigate the world for yourself and those around you. Then when that started happening on a bigger scale, like in business and stuff like that, again, it's not like, it's one of those things that, you know, when we talk about it, it's like, well, what are some things that you find easy that others find hard?
Mm-hmm.
That's not hard for probably us
to
do, because we've done it from such a young age.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know if there's three that stand out, but I'll tell you three that have worked for me.
Okay.
One is, I think negotiation.
Yeah.
Right? So, it's a flow-on off communication,
mm-hmm.
But it's also the ability where, say, if you're not gifted with great communication technical skills,
mm-hmm.
you can use negotiation frameworks still to your advantage,
mm-hmm.
more nearly on a mathematical side.
Mm-hmm.
So, how quickly can you analyze a situation, know the pricing and the benefits, what you've got of value that you have, what's of value that somebody else's has.
Mm-hmm.
I personally believe it's one of outside of, say, sales, we still probably need greater communication, traditional
communication. Well, this is basic arithmetic,
right?
What you're talking about.
This is deal making.
Yeah.
Right? So, it's like, because in my life, most of the value that I've been able to extract has been through negotiation in every facet of it.
You've taught me this.
Like life,
yeah.
Family, loved ones.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I just have it's a fundamental part of my operating system where it's like, to have a aligned and relatively seamless life, the more clarity you can have on what the structure looks like. Like, even if you think about a marriage, it's like, what's the actual agreement here? You know, what are my responsibilities? What's the value exchange? Like, that's fundamentally what it comes down on. I think that's where a lot of relationships break down. Mm. It's when there's a mismatch in the expectation or the exchange of value. It's not clear, right? And we never define it. Like, people sign up when they're 18 or 20 or whatever.
Yeah.
And then 20 years later, they're like, well, what's actually going on here?
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah,
it was good when we were in love and everything was there. But now functionally, how does this actually work as like a partnership, right? And I think that's really important. I think just negotiation and having a basic understanding of deal making, it's probably also one of the best ways if you're coming from a place of disadvantage to, I think, elevate yourself out of disadvantage.
Yeah.
Right? And even whether that's at the level of, I'm going to go on Fiverr, I have a skill set and I'm going to negotiate a deal, deliver a piece of work and then get paid for it. Even then, practicing how you negotiate and how you exchange value is huge. So I'd say that's
awesome.
Right up there.
You've taught me that too. You've helped me learn negotiation to the point where real results. I just negotiated 40% off one of my tech stacks where I was paying like 10 grand a month. It's now like six.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And I just would have never thought to do that.
Like one email, right?
One email.
Yeah.
So it's unbelievable, man.
So knowing that, the big thing there as well is just understanding, well, what's my leverage, right? Like, and where do I sit in this negotiation too is probably one of the big things. So, I think that's probably one of the big ones.
Okay.
Yep. I think the other one that when I look back on it is being very attentive to when the right people have entered my lives to make sure that I do everything in my power to keep them in my life.
Interesting.
I only unlocked this as I was sort of reading the book and looking back on it. But I could nearly tie back. Most of the results come back to those critical people in key chapters of my life.
The irrigation, the trees, the fertilizer. Yeah.
But then also actively making sure that I was doing my part in nourishing that relationship.
And maintaining the value exchange.
And maintaining that.
Yeah.
Right? Now, whether that's with you, whether that's
you've
with
done
Chantel,
that exceptionally well with me.
Whether that's that, I think that becomes nearly, it's not, it's like an unknown skill set. Some people just have it naturally, right?
Yeah.
But it's like, but you do have to connect your heart, your mind, your spirit.
Well, I think people feel uncomfortable talking about transactional value when it comes to relationships.
Yeah.
Like, people are scared to have that conversation because it feels icky. It's basically like a prenup,
right?
It kind of feels a little bit icky, right?
A bit of a
I think there's so much merit to what you're saying.
But you need to have a it's like the more you can formalize, like I don't even have this that much, but it's sort of, most people it happens organically. But some people are just great at managing relationships.
Yeah, for sure.
Right?
For sure.
There's really, like, I wouldn't even say I'm that great at it, but I'm amazing at it with the top few people in my life, I think, but maybe I'm not amazing at it, right? So no, I won't go that far.
Really,
but like,
you're really great,
but like the key ones in there at any given time, I can go pretty deep. But
yeah,
a lot of other people have much greater bandwidth for it.
Mm.
Like for me, it's, I think I'm more naturally as an introvert. It's a little bit harder. Yeah. Like I've got friends of my life that will just call up people for 20 minutes. You know, they'll make 10 phone calls a day and it's just part of their day.
Yeah, yeah.
To me, it's like, it's a real big decision to answer a phone call and to make one. You know, it's not an easy an easy thing that I'm able to do.
I
know,
when you pick up my phone calls, I feel very lucky.
No, there's only like a few
what have I done to deserve this?
There's a few people like that are in there. And I know that's the same for a lot of other people, but it's like, I think it's that. And then it's also knowing like when those mugs, when the use, when these people come into your life, knowing that that is actually uniquely special and in a lifetime, you don't get too many of those instances. So I think I saw that early on, and it's more like, to me, it's just, it trumps anything like financial or anything else that can happen, because the upside, you don't even know like what it unlocks. Right? Like, say, and people make this mistake, right? They'll have somebody that comes into their life like that and they'll over-transact it way too early, right? They'll make the ask too early, or they'll play it a little bit incorrectly. And then all that longer-term opportunity that could have come from it just absolutely disappears.
Wow.
Right?
It's such a big call-out. It's so true. It's so true. It's what could have flourished into a friendship where it's like, if we played this wrong, this podcast would have never existed.
No.
Parts of our businesses wouldn't even exist, because we brought so much our value into each other's lives.
Relationships, like all the other things.
Our kids know each other, love hanging out with each other. Yeah. There's a world of
extended groups.
Yeah. You
know, like all these things. Like it changes everything.
Wow. It's like sliding doors, eh?
Yeah.
Mm. Wow. Okay.
So people.
Third.
I'll go with two. You go for you go with one. I'm going to think of what I think the third is. I want to make the third one good.
I think not being afraid to just try things.
Yeah.
I think one of my things that I've trained, I haven't always been like this. I grew up in a family that was poor. I was always scared to do things. But I've just learned how to not be so afraid of risk. And I think that has served me extremely well. I mean, dude, I moved to America with a 2-month-old kid with no career, with no connections. And I just moved my whole family over there, right? And that opened up an incredible chapter of life. And then I built the whole damn career and I threw it all away and I came back home to start this whole new content creation, online influencer communication teacher career, right? I had no business in doing that, right? And I did it. And I think not being afraid to just try.
Yeah.
And it's like just give it a crack, as the Aussies would say. I'm not afraid to give it a crack.
Yeah. Your combination as well, which is really interesting, is you're so comfortable with front end risk.
Yeah, yeah.
Like
yeah.
I'm not that comfortable with front end. Like I like low sort of downside at the beginning. I started to
know you very well.
And then high upside, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas I've never met anyone that front ends moves like that.
Yeah.
Like, whereas you're just like, I'm jumping and then we'll build it, like on there. But I think you must also then have such a high level of confidence knowing that you're going to figure it out on that way. Because I haven't seen you get it wrong either, like over a pretty long period of time. But but even if you do, right, I would have expected somebody with that approach to get it wrong a lot more and still figure it out over a longer term period. But like, I'm talking like most of the moves are actually pretty spot on, you know? So like, it means that there's something going on where it's just a very aligned strategy to how you operate and how you're able to then navigate and figure that out.
Yeah.
Whereas I know if I played the same way that you do, I wouldn't get it right anywhere near that amount. Like I'd get maybe if you'll say 9 or 10 out of 10, I reckon I'd get 3 using that same strategy, 2 or 3 out of 10, and it would be a disaster.
You shouldn't do it the way I do it.
But like, I think that's very unique to you. Right, you know, like your approach to risk, uncertainty, and just rapid change and iteration.
Well, that's the third thing I would pick, because communication would be number one. Second thing is my approach to just trying and giving things a go.
Risk taking.
Yeah, risk taking. The third thing is really what you just said.
Yep.
It's mastery. Iterations. Kaizen. Whatever you want to call it. It's relentless improvement. always improving it. It's like you noticed today when you arrived in the studio. You said, hey, you got new mic stands.
Yeah,
because I needed a 1% improvement, right? Before, the mic stands were kind of covering your face. The one you were using wasn't comfortable because it was too low. And then I was high and it slightly covered me. So again, I just think, I just look at things as, well, how can I improve things by just 1%
each time
I do it? I'm a tinkerer. Yeah. But that's also, it's paired really well with taking risks.
Yeah.
Because sure, I can take a big risk to many who look at it as, whoa, that's a crazy thing. But I'm like, but I get better every single time I do the thing. So it's only a matter of time before I succeed at that game.
Yeah.
Because I'm not doing the same thing expecting a different result. No, no, no. Every time I do it, it's 1% different. Every time I do it, it's 1% different. And next time you come in here, it will be 1% different again. And it will forever be 1% different. Right? And sometimes that 1% different is negative. But because I review and reflect, I'm now able to shift that negative move into an positive move. So I'm always, like I'm that, there's the classic tortoise and the hare. Everyone's obsessed about being the hare. I'm that tortoise that's just relentless, brother. I'm slow as hell. But I will keep walking.
I reckon you're slow though. I reckon you're a really fast,
fast tortoise. Have you ever seen that? Have you seen that horror movie? I can't remember what it's called, but it's this thing that just keeps following you.
Yeah.
What is it called? It's fucking frightening. It follows. It follows. Have you seen It Follows? Okay, sorry for swearing. But It Follows, right? You never watched a movie?
No.
Okay, so the concept of it.
Like, is it It?
No, 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 it's no, not no, It. Okay, no, no, it's no. It Follows. Okay, yeah, so yeah, this is the concept of the movie. It's, I don't know why I'm relating myself to this, but it's this thing that once you, I think it's once you have sex with someone, right? It's like an STD, right? It then follows you. So now there's this ghost that's just walking towards you slowly.
Yeah.
And you don't know what's happening. And then one day you just see this person that's just following you and you freak out. You try to run away everything, but it's until you make love to another person, then it follows the next person. Right? But so what you do is even if you travel halfway across the world, you'll walk underwater. It'll just, it's going to come after you.
Yeah.
One day, it's going to rock up in your house and you won't even know. So it's creepy as hell, right? That's me. That's basically me, man. That's me with what I put my mind to. I've become this ghost, this creepy thing that just follows you no matter where you go. And you is what I'm after.
That's right? Hilarious.
But like, terrible analogy. You should have just stuck to the tortoise. So, and the, oh, so man. Why
you're no? pretty much an STD. Did you just relate yourself to an STD?
I'm an STD. There you go. So that's what I got from that.
You're like, a sexually transmitted disease. A highly functional performing,
sexually transmitted disease that just follows you wherever you go.
Yeah, but that's hilarious. I hope Pete cuts that up as a snippet.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
That's going to be great for your social media following. It's
great.
Yeah.
But let's go back to the tortoise in the hare. I think that's something.
We're going to go back to
we're going to go back to the tortoise in the hare. Let's keep it PG. But basically, frightening movie. You should watch it. It's pretty good.
Yeah. It Follows is just going to go up the charts right now.
It's a really scary movie. Yeah. But anyway, I believe that if you have those three, those are my three that work for me. And I think it's important to, again, coach John Wooden. If you focus on the things you can't control, you lose control of the things you can control. Yeah. If you can't control the soil you were planted in, if you can't control the irrigation system where it was placed, if you can't control those things, well, then just focus on the things you can control.
Yeah.
And you've listed wonderful things. I've listed some.
Yeah.
You should think about what your controllables are and work on those. You know, and it's...
I'll add one more to it, right?
Okay.
And I think it's an unwavering self-belief.
Yeah.
So not arrogant, like a humble but unwavering self-belief. And I think that also links to outlook on life.
Yeah.
Right? Like... you have to lean just to know that there's silver linings in most things.
Yeah, it's really hard though when you're going through a shit time though.
And you gotta, but that's nearly the skill development, right? Because you learn it in the shit times.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you can always put a silver lining on something when it's good.
Yeah.
But it's like, how do you then practice it when it's not? And I think they're the learning opportunities when we get, again, gifts, right? Like, even though, like, always think about it, like, the death of a loved one or all that.
Yeah.
It's one of the hardest things to sit there.
Man, you went through it with mum.
Like, to put a
silver lining on that.
Or silver lining on what you then learn from it. But they're the things that actually teach us that around, all right, because it transfers into other aspects of life. Because if you can then deal with something like the death of a parent or loss of a child or something like that, it just gives you, like, and you're able to transmute that into an energy force that's nourishing.
Wow.
That also then gives you more self-belief. It then flows into everything else as well. Because that business problem that you're going to have in 2 years' time, it's like, well, kind of already dealt with this. Like, what's this? You know, like it just, it helps us sort of navigate uncertainty a little bit more. And the only thing is, like, because the external world's always going to be uncertain. It's always going to be unpredictable. There's always going to be things that happen. But if you can get that internal, you know, conviction or whatever it is, then, hey, whatever happens, I'm still going to be a relatively steady source and just navigate through it. I'm going to enjoy the good stuff, get sad when there's bad stuff, but I'll be able to sort of work myself through it a little bit. But having a belief that most things I'm going to get through okay.
Well, there's that beautiful quote that you hear Tom Hanks said on a video that went viral. Oh, he says, "It too shall pass.
It too shall pass."
You'll have your time in the sunshine where The Rock will follow you, Chris Pratt will follow you, but it too shall pass. You're having the worst time of your life right now because business sucks and your revenue's down or whatever. It too shall pass.
It does.
And the funny thing is, another line that I love from a movie as well is Dead Poets Society. And it's that, and the powerful play goes on and you get to contribute a verse. It also means that, and this life will pass us by. And while we're here, we get to contribute a verse. You know, and I think there's so much beauty to that quote because it's, this is all finite. It's hard to believe, right? Because I love it when I talk to my younger cousins. I've got some cousins who are like in their early 20s, late teens. And every now and then I hear them say, I heard them say this thing. They go, yeah, if I die, I just, you know, I'm like, dude, it ain't if, man. It's when. It ain't if, man. There's no if about it. Like, you're going to die. That's a destination you and I are both sharing, man. Right? And I think it's probably because I'm getting old and seeing our payone was counting the gray hairs on my head the other night. And I have got more than 25 now. But it's, I'm more than 25. And she's like, oh, you're becoming an old man. But it's just, it's funny because I'm becoming that old man where I'm starting to pick on shit the younger kids are saying. Like, if I, you hear this, not if I die. It's when. Right? It's just.
It's like when Chantel's grandma every time she stays with us in the morning.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, how are you? Good morning. She's like, yeah, it's great. I'm here again.
It's here. She always has like a quip like that.
She's like, what a day. You know, I made it.
I woke up.
Yeah, I woke up. You know, it's like at that point. It's it's such an amazing perspective.
You're getting close, man. Yeah. Well, you know, I know we say
hope not.
I know that every time I say that, there's someone older than me that's just like, look at that idiot. Still a spring chicken.
It's funny, I think. And I try to hesitate from doing this when it's like, oh, we're getting older and using that. And then you speak to somebody who's like in their 70s or 80s and they're like, man, 30, 36, 37, 38. It's like, you're still a kid. Like, you're not even,
I can only say this around you. I would never say this around. Again, situational awareness, practical intelligence. Right. Yeah. I would never say this around a person who's 70.
No.
Wow. All right. Let's jump back in. I mean, another thing that came up really interesting is the KIPP Academy.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting, right? Talk about being able to focusing on the things that you can control and letting go of the things you can't. So the KIPP Academy is a school in New York. And for some reason, this school in the most disadvantaged area with the kids from the most disadvantaged families, 90% of the kids that go there are from single parent families. They have the most admissions into the greatest universities all around the US. And it's like, how the hell did this school, basically in the ghetto, be able to achieve all of this unreal success, and all their kids are so smart and everything? And it's because they realize one thing, that the kids who grew up in wealthy families, during school breaks, they were still continuing their learning journey. They were still learning rich knowledge through life experience, holidays, vacations. Whereas the kids that grew up in the poorer neighborhoods that went to poorer schools, when they were on school holidays, that learning ceased to exist. So then what the KIPP Academy did is that they decided, okay, well, what can we control? Well, you know what? School at the KIPP Academy starts at 7:30 a.m. and it ends at 5 p.m., Monday to Friday. All of a sudden, that increases 50% of the time. You're at school 50% longer than every other school in the world. Second thing they did, well, you know what? Kids are coming in half days on Saturdays. All of a sudden, now you've got an extra half day on every single person per week. And then they go, well, you know what else we can do? During the school breaks, 3 weeks of the school breaks, you're coming into school and we're going to continue the learning experience for you. And then as a result of doing that, dude, it's like 90% of their kids went on to go to university in all these incredible schools, competing against wealthy families. And then that made me think, though. That made me kind of reflect on my journey. And I think one of the reasons why I feel I'm able to be where I am in life is because of entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship was my KIPP Academy. Because where my friends went to a 9 till 5, they went, clocked in at 9, switched off at 5. People glorify entrepreneurship and they go, oh, I can't wait to work for myself or work my own hours. It's like Dana White says, when you work your own hours, that's all hours, man. Yeah. That's freaking working all hours. Yeah. Don't glorify it. It was awful. Yeah. Whereas my friends at the time, I was like, oh, man, you know, they could switch off and they don't have to switch on till 9. Man, I'm up by 6 and I'm out of the office at 9. And that's Monday to Friday. So I remember just doing some math here and I had to use a calculator. But if you work 9 till 5 and let's say that you do 9 till 5 every week of the year, you're working 2,000 hours a year. Mm-hmm. If I'm working the hours that I work, I double your work hours. I've done 4,400 hours of work where you've done 2,000. That's a controllable thing you can do to get ahead.
It's also the difference, right? If you're, say, working in something, are you on autopilot or are you heavily engaged?
Yeah, well, that's right. See, that's another layer of it.
So, like, if you're, say, working for yourself.
Yeah, you are not on autopilot, man.
A lot of the time, you don't get to go on autopilot.
You can't.
Because it's not like-
Things are always happening.
Like, I remember when I was working for someone else, there was a lot of autopiloting going on.
Yeah.
You're switched on at times, but nowhere near as like
when you're doing your tuned own thing. Up. Well, that's what happens when you join an entrepreneurial environment. Is that your brain is you're using it.
Entrepreneurship as well. Like fundamentally, I think somebody was talking about it. I can't remember what book it was, but they're like entrepreneurship is actually quite a spiritual and creative act because you're taking something so unknown and so uncertain, and you're embodying yourself into a project with a high level of uncertainty, right? Like it's like painting a picture nearly of your ideas.
Yeah.
Colin. And I actually think one of the reasons why I got drawn to it is because as I started playing that game, I realized, hey, it's not even just about being good at business or learning or reading. Because at the start, I'm like, oh, you just got to learn everything and you got to apply it and you got to find a good product or whatever it is. But fundamentally, to play it for a longer period of time, you actually have to transform yourself. Like, that's the biggest thing now when I look back over my journey as an entrepreneur. It's like, yeah, the business is amazing and, like, that is what it is. But the coolest thing is like, well, what did I have to turn into?
Who did I have to become?
To be, like, to play that game for an extended period of time.
That's a really good point.
Like, I think about, like, would I have gotten into, like, spirituality if I wasn't doing entrepreneurship? Probably not.
Probably not.
Right? I probably would have stuck with drinking. Mm. You know, that would have been the more functional route to get into that space, right? But it was like, how do you find, and like, there were so many different things where I had to become more like, I had to evolve or change my mindset and so many different things to actually play that game. But then that also had a compounding effect because it made me better in other areas, right? So it's like, how can you find things that are your version of that and then allow you to make that same transformation, right? Because that's ultimately what it's about. Like the things that we have, that we acquire, that we do, they're going to be finite. They exist on the external level. But it's like, how do you actually then transform and transmute yourself as an individual over that time? And I think that's ultimately what life's about, right? Like it's like a development journey or-
And a huge part of who you become is based on what you do.
Yeah.
What you do for work.
Yep.
That shapes who you become, brother.
For sure.
To the point where when you ask people, hey, what do you do? Like they'll use their profession.
Yeah.
Right? Their identity is generally attached to their profession.
Yeah.
It's like, tell me about you. Yeah. Oh, I run FutureGolf. Tell me about you. I'm an accountant. Tell me about you. I'm a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, people identify a lot.
Whereas I think, again, down the path of entrepreneurship, and again, this is not to glorify it, say it's better or not. You pick your own path. You do what's right for you. But down one path, if you do 9 to 5, that's 2,000 hours of you transforming into the future you. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that may be unconscious at certain points. Mm-hmm. Like you said, autopilot. Whereas if you go down the path of entrepreneurship, it's 4,000 hours of you transforming into someone different.
Mm-hmm.
One, you spend a lot more time crafting and sculpting. One, you spend less time.
Yep. And maybe the lesson there is like, the book talks about this too. A lot of the indicators of success were based on having the opportunity to practice at a high volume, right? So when you talk about the KIPP Academy, all of a sudden these students will now get another 40% of practice.
Yeah, 50% of practice more.
Right? When you think about really great athletes, a lot of the times they go through academies where it's designed for that. It's specialized. Just about practicing that sport in a really elite environment.
Yeah.
Right? So there's probably going to be these elements of like, well, what elite environment or what parameters of practice you need to create for yourself. If you're saying, hey, I'm going to be the next Vin at social media or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, well, realistically, how's that broken down? are you in an environment with creators?
Mm.
Do you have access to the David Griggses that you spoke about earlier that give you that? Like, you know, even when you go back to, say, the tech boom, it happens in condensed spaces where it's hot right there. You know, like Silicon Valley was the epicenter of it. They'd look at the textile boom that was in New York back in the 40s.
Mm. Well, dude, my speaking career, I had to uproot myself from Australian soil and replant myself in American soil
for that,
to get to play in the top arenas over there.
Mm-hmm. And I think the beauty is nowadays, a lot of things can be done online. Online, so those barriers are open.
How crazy is that?
When you went online, you're like, hey, I can go back home. Yep.
Yep. I can be anywhere in the world and serve people from all over the world from my studio. Yeah.
I think just generally, we're living in a time right now where the barriers of entry are the lowest that they've ever been.
It's so ridiculous.
Right? I think back even to us, like where we grew up, like I'm looking at our generation, it's probably the start of it.
Yeah.
Realistically, if you grew up in Australia in the last 20, 25 years, there's a varying, like there's better schools and there's some worse schools. The general standard of education is pretty good.
Yeah.
Like if you really put it in there, even if you go to one of the worst schools, you might have some disadvantages, but there's no actual legitimate ceiling that stops you other than maybe peer group or like access to some of the resources. Mm. You've got a pretty good chance. Like the school I went to, we were in like the bottom 4% of university transition. I'm certain
the one I went to was the same thing.
You know, like, but it was still possible for those students that wanted to give it a go, to give it a go. Whereas I think in some countries that doesn't necessarily exist.
Yeah.
You know, there is a barrier there. In some countries, like depending what caste you're from, what social group you're from, there's walls there, right? So putting yourself, if you can, in an environment, like if you're fortunate enough to live in an environment where those barriers, like, there's always going to be levels of advantage, right? Mm. Based on race, your upbringing, all of that. Just don't see what you can leverage. You know, so many people get fixated on
that. Focus on the things you can control. Well,
like I hear it all the time. It's like, oh, I'm Indian, so I can't do this.
Yeah. Hey, I'm Vietnamese, so this, same thing, bro.
Like
same
I grow up, my family's like this, so I can't do it. It's all that. Like, or like, you know, we see it all over the world. And the reality is that's human nature playing out the way it does. If you think about it, like people, if they have an advantage, if there's a subgroup of people that have an advantage, they're probably going to try to keep that advantage.
Oh, yeah.
Right? But time in societies will change where that will happen because there'll be people in a minority that will then speak up or they'll change the game and then they'll unlock it for everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like we see that. And we see that in society. It evolves. It continues to evolve like that.
Yeah.
But you just need to find out, well, what are the things that I actually can play?
Yeah. What are my advantages? Yeah. Because play to that.
Everyone's going to have disadvantages that they won't be able to play. Like, say if you're somebody that grew up from multi-generational wealth and you were silver spooned everything, it's probably going to be hard for you to go and do a startup.
Yeah.
You know? You won't have that advantage. Yeah. You're going to have to do it the way your family's done it for generations. So it's like everyone still, even those with the advantage, have a disadvantage or they get too held in on tradition and then they miss the opportunity and they get disrupted and it's all gone.
Yeah.
Right, like so it's like that exists everywhere. Like even if you're sitting there, like there's no such thing as a pure advantage. It's so subjective.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah,
it's true.
Well,
I just think that sometimes people always focus on the things they can't control.
For sure,
I still remember this. I still remember even in my industry, the speaking industry, where you couldn't travel and speak anymore.
Yeah.
So many people in my industry were complaining about the government not letting them travel.
Yeah,
like I just went, well, you know what?
Yeah,
can I influence South Australian borders?
Yeah.
Probably not. Really unlikely that, and let alone can I influence Victorian borders who shut down really hard? So if I can't influence that, I'm not going to waste the breath complaining about it. I'm going to work on building a world-class virtual studio and I'll teach people from Victoria, from South Australia, from my house.
But why didn't you just spend the whole time complaining?
Well, that's just,
like, that would have been way better.
But honestly, if I believed there was a chance that my complaining could change the border conditions between states, I probably would have done it.
Yeah.
But my firm belief was, well, I can't impact that.
I remember the day after it was announced that the borders were closing, I think I spoke to you. And you had a studio set up in the version.
I was painting.
I'm like, dude, are you all right? Like, you've just gone. He's like, yeah, just went down to Best Buy and just got all this stuff. Built a studio.
I think if we just, if we were a little more obsessive about focusing on the things we could control,
yeah,
we'd all do a lot better.
Yeah, it's It's a great.
It's a stoic path, right? And you know what? You know what? The stoics boil it down even more pragmatic than that. Yeah. There's only two things you can control in your life: your thoughts and your actions. That's it.
And this is what I hope as well, right? Like, I really hope that we're not at a level where we've gotten so comfortable. That say if there is like the equivalent of like the Great Depression that happens.
Okay.
I hope that I have this belief that even if the Great Depression happens, I'm just going to figure it out. Yeah, you know, like it's like to the best of my ability.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, if there's a controllable there, like if that then means like, all right, now I just need to become a baker.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, dude, I'd be good at that.
I'm going to do like whatever it is there. Like,
you bake bread, I'll make steaks. We'll make steak sandwiches.
Yeah, really, really bad baker. Your steak's still going to be pretty good. So you're going to have to offset the shitty bread.
The shitty bread, But that's all right. But no one's going to be able to afford to buy our steak sandwiches.
Hey, but like it'll be that though, right? It's like, I think that's also a thing. It's like whatever the environment is, because say for example, like the pandemic was probably the most recent thing that we've had in our generation. You were still like, all right, lemons, how do we turn it into lemonade? Right. And I think that's just a mindset. So it means that if there's 10 million people, but there's a very small percentage of people that are thinking like that, even when there is a downturn, a macroeconomic downturn or whatever, or a societal downturn, having that mindset should still give you an advantage. Even in there, or it's going to be the other way where it's like, all right, well, Vin can only be good when things are flourishing.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
But, yeah.
Cool. All right. Feels like we're coming to a nice little soft landing there. Not to be weird, but that was the longest pause we've had so far.
I like it.
I'm just looking through my notes to see if there's anything else that I want to bring up.
Yeah. Same.
And, look, I really wanted to mention this. I had to talk about this one again.
Okay, cool.
And it's there are certain cultural advantages and disadvantages that are baked in.
Yeah.
And I just remember rereading this going, God damn, this is so true.
Mm-hmm.
American Airlines versus Korean Airlines.
Yeah.
All right. So in America, in the American Airlines, this was back in the, I can't remember what the period was, but essentially they would have one plane accident out of 4 million flights.
Yeah.
Whereas the Koreans had 5 accidents out of every 4 million flights. Yeah. And they were like, why is there a 5x difference between?
No, there's a 17x difference.
Was it 17x
difference? It was a 17x difference with the Korean Airlines. Yeah.
Okay, so again, that even makes a better case study, right?
Yeah.
So it was 17x difference. So 17 planes would crash if I have an accident out of 4 million, right?
Yeah.
So then they researched as to why this happens. Is it the engineering? Is it the people not doing the checks? Mm-hmm. And they boiled it down that in America, the second in charge would not be afraid to raise to the first in charge, hey, I think we shouldn't take that route because of the weather. We should take this route, it's safer. Whereas in the Korean culture, it's really disrespectful to question the first in charge. And as a result of that, even when the second pilot goes, I don't think we should take that path, it's too risky, they would never voice that opinion because of the cultural forms of like respect, that you never question your leaders. And that was the reason why it was 17 times more dangerous to fly on Korean Airlines.
Mm.
And the reason why that hit me so hard was because, dude, when I first became a keynote speaker, anytime there was a person that was older than me in the audience, which was all the time, I just went, nah, this feels wrong.
Yeah.
I shouldn't be keynoting at this conference because clearly that guy is at least 60. And I felt so uncomfortable speaking there, which would often hinder my performance because I felt so disrespectful that I'm teaching that man who's clearly 3 times my age wisdom. Who the hell am I?
It's embedded in the culture.
It's embedded in the culture, man. And I got to tell you, that's what America helped me fix. Because in America, people believe in themselves so much more. Even when you look at it and you go, yeah, I don't know if you should believe in yourself that much. But there's a beauty in that because what you said before, self-belief.
Yeah.
It's going to serve you more than
yeah.
a lack of it. And I think-
America collectively has a lot of self-belief.
Has a lot of self-belief. But dude-
the most out of any
in any country, and that and I have to attribute credit where credit is due.
Yeah.
After living in America for 4 to 5 years, I really believe in my abilities.
Hmm.
Whereas before that, man, like a simple thing, right? If you tried to compliment me in any way, shape, or form, pre-2015.
Pre-America.
No. It's not me.
It's the Australian way.
It's not me.
We don't
it's the Australian way. We don't take compliments, right? But America helped me learn how to accept love, accept these wonderful gifts. Because, dude, I still remember the first time I did that to someone in America, they're like, honey, you are really good at this. and you need to accept this gift that I'm giving you, because this is going to help you become better. Whereas if you keep throwing it away, you won't believe in yourself, right? And it was just so beautiful, this moment I had with this lady, and we're in like Phoenix, Arizona, and she really made me go, wow, I've never had someone compliment me. I took it, threw it in the bin. She took it out of the bin, gave it back to me and explained to me why I need to accept this gift.
Yeah.
And I kind of just went, wow.
Well, in Australia, we only celebrate humility, right? Like, yeah, if you think about it, it's the only
thing.
Right. And it's not self-celebration. It's somebody else.
Yeah.
Do it. It's like indirect celebration.
It's both important though.
Yeah.
It's both important. Mm. And that's why I think if you do find that there's some cultural things that you have learned, it's important to unlearn them as well. Because like that Korean Airlines situation, 17 times more accidents happen. 17 times more people die because you don't have enough self-belief to stand up for saying something when you believe that it's right. There are versions of that in your own life. Because here's the thing, right? If you don't fully accept those compliments, if you don't take them in and allow it to nourish you, you may never become that confident version of you that comes up with an idea that creates an incredible life for yourself. Like, you think it's small, but it's not. It's not.
Massive.
That small change in the way you accept things can fundamentally change the life that you live and the people that you surround yourself with and your self-worth. All of it.
Yeah.
It did it for me.
I'm worthy, like, to accept it.
That's right. Yeah. I'm worthy. And that plays a lot on self-confidence, self-capability, self-belief, the future that you dare to dream up. It all comes from these things. And I think every culture has its own challenges, right? Because then there's such a thing as and I feel bad for the Americans with this too. Because, dude, living in America, I developed so much love for them. And it's that sometimes people go, oh, they're too much. But that is true. That can happen as well, right? You can, because there's a certain point where it becomes arrogance,
yeah.
Right? So,
yeah,
I don't know. I just had to bring that example up.
The big thought that came up to me there is like when you look at countries like India, you look at countries like China now, just Asia in general, traditionally and culturally, probably even Latin America to a position, it's so family dominated, you know, like around the collective in a way, and it's generational. It's like, don't speak out of turn, don't do any of these things. Like, if you think about it right now, one of the biggest things that's probably happening in the world is like yours, mine, our generation are probably the first generation at mass that are like going outside the norms of what was decided for you by your family.
True.
Right? And it's nearly unlocked a whole half of the population that are now like thinking a little bit differently, dreaming a little bit differently, acting a little bit differently, unlocking different opportunities. Like, again, you go back to that intersection, right? Like this, again, looking at the threads. The fact that you were a Vietnamese guy that did magic and that wanted to speak to people. That is a combination made you so unique at the period of time that you did that.
Yeah, it's true.
Because there wasn't too many other people with those three attributes.
Dude, and a skill set. I looked up a speaking bureau at the time I was in the US to see how many other speakers from my background with magic speaking, blonde hair, Asian.
Yeah.
No one.
Yeah.
There was maybe six I saw. Interesting, isn't
it? So like you're going into a blue ocean.
Yeah.
Right. It is. When they're looking for like and I'm guessing back then the average speaker was probably a white person, 60 years old,
male,
50 years old. They're not going to have the same level of energy and what you're bringing to that.
Yeah, all of a sudden,
this thing's now sticky.
I was exotic.
Memorable.
Yeah.
But like then you mix that with skill, practice, all the other bits and pieces to it. That is a force, right?
Like, it sounds a little bit like Crocodile Dundee.
Well, to me, it's like it's a bit like when in the NBA until like the 60s, African-American people couldn't play basketball.
Right.
Right? Like, so then you think about it. It's like that. Like Bill Russell and these players, like they paved the way ultimately for Michael Jordan to then come along. Right. And there's great stand-up comedians out there that are like, you know, like I think Andrew Schultz is one of them. He's like, I would have loved playing like they should have like it would have been awesome like back then in the 60s. Like even I could have played in the NBA.
Not anymore.
You know, like now it's like you got no chance, right? But these things like these cultural shifts are absolutely game-changing in terms of the opportunities that they then open up for people, right? And then you would have paved the way probably for more Asian speakers to then come into there, because they've been like, Vin's so great. This is awesome. We need more diversity. We need all of these things. So like these things, like it was the same with golf, right? Because golf's primarily always been an older
same thing as the speaking world
and like I used to get messages all the time, like when they'd see me, it's like, oh, I'm like an Indian person or an Asian person. Like I didn't even think that golf was really an option until you, like you nearly have to see it to then believe it, right?
It's true.
But yeah, that's really interesting around that.
I've got a message cultural that I kind of want to leave the audience with for this one, for this particular book. And then I'd love to hear from you too, if you've got a message too, okay? Use this time to think if you have one.
I don't.
You probably don't.
I've said all my messages.
All right, sure. Yeah. Then
I need like an extra message after all the messages.
Yeah, well,
like,
if you got one.
I feel like it's been like 2 hours of messages. So
if,
like,
if you've got one, you've got one. If you don't,
like big,
you don't.
I don't have like a big finale.
Stop getting all self-conscious.
I don't have like a big finale.
I've got a crescendo planned. And if you don't have one, that's your problem.
And then like you say yours. And then I've got to come with like a really shitty made-up crescendo.
Why don't you go with your little shitty crescendo first, and then I can end with a proper crescendo.
You know what? I'm going to let the master do what the master
does. You don't
want to
do one?
No, you do your
you
thing.
Really don't want to do
no
one? Okay. All right. Well, I thought this book really reminded me of the quote where we always overestimate what we can do in 12 months, and we underestimate what we're truly capable of in 12 years. And what this book really brought me back to is whatever I choose to do or you choose to do or our listeners choose to do in the next chapter of life, while the world is obsessed with easy, while the world is obsessed with I want things tomorrow, be the tortoise. Be the one that continually goes through the mastery reps and just relentless. Every single time I do this, I'm going to be 1% better. Every single time I do this, I'm just going to continually move forward and get better. And I'm going to be more obsessed about slow progress than overnight success. And I will see you at the top in 12 years' time. You will get there. And I will see you there. Put in the number of thousands of hours that's required, and I will see you at the top. And Ali will be there too. And we'll celebrate.
Love it. And if you can't be bothered doing the work, just be open when somebody knocks on the door and they're there to give you a gift. Just accept it and act on it.
Yeah.
Because that can also fast track that process just a little bit.
It can. It can be a cheat code.
Yeah.
But if no one knocks on the door,
then work.
Stick to the mastery cycle.
Tortoise is better.
Because that's what you can control. All right. I love it. The moment you come in, it's like a violin out of tune. Right? Yeah. No, but hey, look, thank you so much for supporting the show. Thank you so much for listening to the Vin and Ali show. I really miss this.
Yeah. Oh, we're going to do more.
Yeah, we're excited to do more as we settle into life. So look, wherever you are, wherever you're tuning in from, we hope you have an awesome rest of your day. See you in the next episode. Hi, hello, it's Vin. Thank you so much for listening to the Vin and Ali show. We've created something that we're really excited about and we want to share it with you. It's called Recalibrate. It's a 12-step process that helps you create more clarity and more alignment in your life. It's the exact approach that both Ali and I have been using to live happier lives and to achieve all of our wildest dreams in the last 7 years. It's been crazy. Being one of our loyal listeners, we wanted to share a special something with you. Visit recalibrate.online/Vin and Ali to access the course for 70% off. I hope you will check it out.